A couple of housekeeping announcements today. One, if there's anyone in the audience who does have a cell phone, I would ask that you turn it off so that it doesn't interrupt the proceedings. And two, there is an overflow room today in Hearing Room D. And so if you can't get in this room, there is another room available. Individuals who are testifying, I would ask that you focus, one, on the issue of the prioritization of the population and the benefits. I would also ask that you restrict your comments to 2 to 3 minutes. There's a lot of people who want to testify, and we would try to hope to allow everyone the opportunity. Additionally, if we do not complete testimony today, we will also convene tomorrow at 1 p.m. In Hearing Room A. For those of you who have written testimony, would you bring it forward, and if you don't get that in today, we will accept it following the hearing as late as tomorrow. So those are some of the just some of the little standards that I'd like to go over with you. And I'm sure that other members will be trailing in. With that, the first person that I will call up is Kelly Kaiser.
I wonder for a minute, Madam Chair, if I was just here to define the parameters of the committee.
Yes, Senator Fish. Good afternoon.
Thank you for allowing us this time to speak today. I'm here representing the Medicaid Advisory Committee.
Ms. Kaiser, would you, for the record, state your name?
My name is Kelly Kaiser, and I'm the co-chair of the Medicaid Advisory Committee.
Thank you.
The Medicaid Advisory Committee is statutorily charged with advising the Department of Human Services on all aspects of Oregon's Medicaid program. And as you can see from our attached testimony, we took the liberty to write a letter in April encouraging the legislature to continue to look for viable revenue options, feeling that that was an important piece, recognizing the political pieces involved in that, and have attached that for review, wanting to reiterate our feelings of how important that is. It is our understanding that the goal of today is to provide testimony on the prioritization of population served and the benefit packages provided. And the Medicaid Advisory Committee believes that the logical response to that question is to continue to look for ways to raise revenue. The fundamental building blocks of the Oregon Health Plan were really to ration benefits, not people. And continuing to remind everybody of that is one of our goals and one of the things we hope to accomplish today. Should the need arise that we do have to ration populations or benefits, we hope that it will be approached in a logical and medically based approach, and as opposed to just sweeping cuts across the board of different benefits, because that puts us in the situation of determining that one person's health is more important than somebody else's, which wasn't one of the basis of the Oregon Health Plan. And really quickly, we'd like to give a quote from Michael Garland, who is one of our committee members, in a letter written to the Oregon Health Council. "We are now in an immediate and desperate circumstance driven by a fiscal emergency. I believe we as a state community brought this crisis upon ourselves, and in my view, any decision about priority among vulnerable populations is at best a decision about the lesser of two evils. If a desperate decision is forced on us in the short term by dire fiscal circumstances, we must move away from it in the long term. We must try to make our short-term choice of a lesser evil also a strategic choice." And just wanted to make sure that we continued to try and look at the broader picture in the fundamentals of the Oregon Health Plan in terms of benefits versus people. And wanted to close by saying that Oregon has been perceived both nationally and internationally as a leader in creating innovative strategies in the healthcare finance and delivery system, and we need to continue to lead by stepping forward with new and bold approaches that allow us to maintain and expand access to healthcare. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Kaiser. Is Jean Thorne? Oh, I didn't see her back there, Jean. And is Barry here? Barry Cass? Well, he's over there. Why don't I have Gene and Barry both come up at the same time? And Tina kitchen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jean Thorne, the Director of the Department of Human Services, and with me is Barry Cast, who's the Assistant Director for Health Services, and Dr. Tina Kitchen, who's the Medical Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities. We just wanted to point out a few things to you as you go through these considerations, and Barry and Tina will cover most of this. First of all, one thing to remember is that the Oregon Health Plan really is interwoven in so much of what the department does. And I think what you'll see from both Barry's testimony and Tina's is to better understand that for certain groups or services, if they are not covered, that in turn may cause cost shifts to other parts of the department or other parts of government. And so we have not, until we kind of land on something a little bit more, we haven't tried to estimate what some of those offsetting costs are, but wanted to alert you to some of those issues. And Barry and Tina will talk more about that. I was asked to tell you what we know about the new federal law that was just passed that would allow enhanced federal Medicaid match to the states and what strings are attached to that, because it's something that you need to be aware of as you're working through this. As you know, the bill that passed last week, I believe was just signed, provides state fiscal relief, and there's two pieces to it. One is an enhanced Medicaid match of 2.95% for five quarters, beginning this past quarter, beginning the last two quarters of federal fiscal year 2003 and the first three quarters of fiscal year 2004. The estimate that the federal government had provided of how much they think that will provide to Oregon is about $100 million. We are looking at those revisions because it may have been based on some of our past expenditures when we were spending more, so it may be somewhat less than that. The other piece of it, which is called flexible assistance, is in essence a grant to the state of about $116 million to use for a variety of purposes. But back on the enhanced Medicaid match, there are some strings. There are some maintenance of effort requirements, and some of this is still fuzzy. But a key provision that you need to be aware of is that in order to keep all of the money to which we are entitled, we must not restrict our Medicaid eligibility.
Excuse me, Jean.
Mm-hmm. Jean, I apologize for interrupting you, but are you speaking from a document or just speaking kind of...
Well, I'm speaking from something the feds sent out, that the federal funds information for states. So I don't have anything in writing on this. I'm assuming the fiscal staff have something from probably NCSL.
As a matter of fact, could we get either a copy of that or something from your office that summarizes what you're telling us? It's very difficult to hear just tangential discussions about something we have no documentation in front of us with. And I'm looking at documentation being passed out that's clearly associated with someone else's presentation. I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
Oh, that's so. The other parts of the department.
I'm confused.
Okay, I'm trying to do an introductory. So, Madam Chair and Senator Menace, we can send you this. It doesn't answer questions because we have some questions. And so I'll lay out what we...
Right, but you're referring to some federal act.
Yes.
I just don't know what the heck it is that you're referring to.
Okay, it's the tax cut bill that included fiscal relief. There is a maintenance of effort provision that requires that states not restrict their Medicaid eligibility below that which is in effect on September 2nd of this year.
Would you please turn off that?
It's not yours.
It's not mine.
Okay. Now, we are working with the federal government to determine what in effect means, and we do know it relates both to Medicaid eligibility and to eligibility under 1115 waivers, which is the waiver we currently have under the health plan. And if there are optional groups, such as pregnant women that maybe you no longer want to cover under Medicaid, and you want to reduce that eligibility, it would need to be done quickly And if it could be done under a state plan amendment, it would need to be in effect prior to September 2nd in order for us to claim this money. On the 1115 waivers, because we have to negotiate that with the federal government, we believe if you would want to eliminate coverage for standard, we don't believe it could be done prior to September 2nd. Most likely what would happen is the federal government requires a phase down, and that would mean probably January 1st. What we think that means, and we are trying to get, and Lynn Reed will be going to Medicaid Director's meeting next week to try to get more clarification, is that we could claim, if you eliminated coverage for standard as of January 1, we likely would still be able to claim the enhanced match, so an additional 2.95% for the current quarter, the next quarter, and then the last quarter of this calendar year, but we would forego the enhanced match for the other two quarters that are part of this. So as you work through this, to recognize that there are some potential implications of actually reducing eligibility. You can reduce benefits, but you can't reduce eligibility without some kind of potential loss of some of that enhanced match. And we'll be working with, as we get more answers to questions, we'll be working with the legislative staff to provide that information to you. So it's something to be aware of. It does not relate to CHIP, though. So CHIP eligibility you can do with what you want, and also the enhanced match is not on the CHIP program. It's just on Medicaid.
Ms. Manager.
Senator Morissette.
Gene, we're going to be meeting on Saturday to make some decisions, mm-hmm. and we have to make open-ended decisions mm-hmm. then.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, many states are grappling with these. We are trying to get the answers. Federal government's trying to figure out what this means as well. But I think I think we can clearly say that if you do eliminate standard, unless there's some way to get it over and done and in effect before September 2nd, which I really don't think there's a way to do that given the negotiations that need to occur with the federal government, you will have some loss of the enhanced match. The question is how many quarters of it.
Gene, since this is in kind of a state of evolution, could you provide this panel with the a copy of the legislation and with any summaries that you may have, or discussion that you may have from both other states and the feds, and it will assist before we convene on Saturday.
Okay, we'll do that, Madam Chair. The last point I wanted to make was that I had not watched some discussions last week, but I understand there was some discussion about the possibility of prioritizing medically needy before standard. And just something I'd like to point out is that if the medically needy program is restored and standard isn't, that it easily will increase the size of the medically needy program, because there will be people who would probably meet, many people would meet the criteria under medically needy, who would now spend down, and as you remember yesterday, is a very complicated program to run. So it's something, again, we just want you to keep in mind of recognizing if medically needy is restored and standard isn't, that would probably increase the size of the medically needy program as well. With that, I would like Barry to talk briefly about some of the issues around mental health and chemical dependency, and then Tina to talk about some of the issues around the long-term care population and some of the services or eligibility groups that are on your list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry Cass, Assistant Director for Health Services. I wanted to give you some information about the mental health and chemical dependency benefit that was provided to the standard population before March 1st. And I wanted to give you just a little bit of background. During the 1980s and through the mid-90s, the state pursued a policy of maximizing its general fund through providing more services to Medicaid-eligible individuals. In the mid-90s, those benefits were then added to the Oregon Health Plan. When they were cut this winter, it had a significant and differential impact and really pulled the rug out from under programs. Let me give you some of the data about what has happened, and these are data for calendar year 2002. During 2002, 29,000 eligibles were served who were eligible under the standard benefit, couples and adults, were served in either mental health or chemical dependency programs. 13,500 of those were in chemical dependency, 16,000 nearly in mental health. This group consumed about 18% of the cost of pharmaceuticals, mental health pharmaceuticals, and 22% of the prescriptions that were written for pharmaceuticals were written for this group. That's 390,000 prescriptions. The point I'm making is that this is a non-trivial benefit. It served a lot of people. And cutting that benefit has had some significant impacts. We did not know earlier how high-risk a population this was, from the perspective of the use of hospital resources and other medical resources, and also from the perspective of the Child Welfare and Child Protective Service Program. The first effect was that the alcohol and drug treatment contractors lost about 60% of their revenue because that had all been shifted into the health plan. The criminal justice system experienced significant reductions too. This population uses a lot of services under the for people who have been convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants. The methadone program, nearly 3,000 people who were maintained on methadone were served under this benefit. The drug courts, which were there to divert people out of criminal justice, in many cases have lost access to services, and acute mental health care has been increasing. Not surprisingly, since the benefit produced an outpatient service, we've seen about a 50% reduction in outpatient visits since March.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marcet.
Larry, do you have something that you... The two sheets that I have do not correspond. Well, do you have anything in writing that you're giving us lots of facts and figures, which are very helpful, but I can't write them all down.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we can provide graphic representation of these data, but they were not ready at the time for this hearing. I apologize for that. Finally, I'm told by our colleagues in child welfare that about 30% of the children in foster care have parents who are involved with alcohol and drugs as a major issue in reuniting that family. And in Child Protective Services cases, about 41% of those cases have a drug and alcohol component. Many of these families are eligible under this benefit and therefore do not have services available provided through the Medicaid program. This, I think, illustrates the importance of the mental health and chemical dependency benefit. If the population is restored and provided in your proposal, this is a critical part of the health care delivery system, and it has an impact on other parts of the human services system. And so I hope you'll take these data into account, and I will see to it that you get this in writing before Saturday.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities, and I am the source of your pieces of paper that you have in front of you. I'm sorry for the confusion. I don't want to try to add to the complexity of the chore that you folks have before you, but there are two important sort of concepts that you need to keep in mind as you go through your most difficult task. The first of which is a population that you haven't heard about yet, which is the Employed People with Disabilities Program, which is another optional program under OHP, and you have a piece of paper that sort of gives some of the basics of that. This is a federal optional program from 1997 that was designed to solve the policy problem of people with disabilities who said they could not afford to work because they would lose their benefits. And this program allows people with disabilities to maintain Medicaid services, both the medical services through OHP and the long-term care services, to let them work. It would cost approximately $3.5 million to fund this for 18 months of the next biennium, and you have those characteristics in front of you. The next concept, if there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer that. But the next concept is, again, Gene started on the interrelatedness between long-term care and Oregon Health Plan, and there are some ways that you need to be aware of. And in particular, if you were to decide not to fund the optional services for the Medicaid mandatory population, there would be a reduction in the client contribution to long-term care for those people who decided to use the optional services and pay for them out of their pocket. It would be a one-on-one reduction from our budget. The second one is that those optional services include therapies, hospice, and some other very important services. If people do not have access to those in their homes, there will be an increased push into going into a nursing facility, and so therefore increase costs through that. Especially for therapies, we would anticipate that there will be an impact on the rates of the nursing facilities because of the nursing facilities' federal survey requirements. They are required to provide necessary care. And if OHP doesn't fund those therapies, there will be a shift either to their all-inclusive rate, or if they are not able to continue to provide that care, we will lose those services which we're required to maintain access towards. Then the last sort of point I'd like to make is there's some gray areas between the mandatory services and the optional services. The biggest gray area is between home health, which is a mandatory service, and the optional services of therapies and hospice. And so you're likely to see people who have those sorts of needs shifting into a mandatory service, and at times that will be at a higher cost than what they currently are receiving.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
For the benefit of the individuals in Room D, so that you will know that you may be on deck, I will call this next group up, and then I will call the group that will follow them, so that if you're in that following group, know that you need to come to this room to be ready to testify. And with that, we do have a policy here at the Capitol to make certain that individuals who have traveled long distances to come to testify, that we make sure that they're accommodated, and also individuals who have special needs. And I want to call Rick Trelevin and Ann Ulu and Tim Hartnett. If they're new, I did. Oh, and Jim Davis.
Jeff Davis,
I'm sorry. And Jeff's from my own Marion County. He's in the back of the room. And on deck is Randy Cervisto, Jamie Schumann, and Dan Perkins.
Hi.
I think we have.
Oh, gosh.
Anne, would you like to begin since you're on this side?
Okay. Thank you, Senator Winters and committee senators. I'm Anne Uhler. I am a board member of the Women's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Issues in Oregon. And you've recently received a letter from us, and so this is a nice time to follow up with that letter to you about our concerns about treatment for alcohol and drug issues in women in the state of Oregon. The commission was established in 1985, and I'm pleased to say that there's been great advances in treatment, alcohol and drug treatment for women and women and children in the state of Oregon until March 1st of this year. We have been very proud of the fact that Oregon has had more women's treatment slots per capita than any other state in the union. And I know that several of you have visited those very treatment sites. What I want to tell you and talk just very briefly, follow up our letter about a concern we have. Assuming that A&D will stay as a benefit for the plus. That makes that assumption. Now, I don't know if that's true with you, but that's an assumption we've made, that you will continue to allow A&D treatment for pregnant women and women and children under the health plan. And that part of what you're trying to consider is for additional population of women. One of the things that Barry Cass alluded to, and I just want to put a little more finite picture on that for you, about women. There are many women in this state who have lost custody temporarily, and so that means their children are in foster care. In order to get those children back, they have to have A&D treatment. These are indigent women. So if you don't include A&D for these women, there's no way that they're going to be able to get their children back out of foster care. And the estimate is that that will cost $25 million additional foster care in the next biennium if you don't provide some services for them. So if you took that $25 million and added the Medicaid match, you'd have $75 million to spend for treatment for that population. Well, it's not going to take that much for treatment. But I just want you to know that because March 1st, those women cannot get services, they therefore cannot get their children back, and that means that you have to have that much more foster care. And that's assuming you're going to find enough people that are willing to do foster care. And I don't think we want to be the state that begins warehousing babies in orphanages and group homes because we can't find foster care because we have such a need. So you have an opportunity here to make sure that doesn't happen. The one other thing that wasn't mentioned by OMAP that I want to remind you, and you may not remember this. When we first started the health plan, there was a whole group of pent-up need by a group of women between the ages of 45 and 65. That was a surprise, both to the actuaries and to OMAP. And when they started looking at that group of women for health services, they discovered that these were women who had become divorced or widows, or were employed in very low positions, so they had no health insurance. And suddenly, when they started offering that service, they started walking in the door much, many, many more than we ever predicted. Well, if you look at that population, I call them the caregivers, because many of that 45 to 50 to 65-year-olds are taking care of their parents, of their disabled adults. And yet now, if we do away with standard, they will not have any health coverage for themselves. So once again, we'll have that pent-up need in health services to women. That's a group of women who still do not access A&D treatment, and it's one that needs to be, we need to devise some treatment for that group also. They're slowly killing themselves by drinking. We know that, and if we want to take care of our caregivers to take care of us at some point, we need to make sure that they get some health services. So that's my addition to our letter, and we just urge you to make sure that women of all ages receive health care for the many reasons that we talked about. Thank you.
Rick for letter.
Thank you. Senator Winters and committee. My name is Rick Trelevin. I'm the executive director of Best Care Treatment Services in Central Oregon, and I'm the mental health director for Jefferson County. And on this 50th anniversary of the first climb of Mount Everest, I appreciate the mountain that y'all have to climb here to solve these problems. And what I'm asking for you folks to consider is to extend the chemical dependency benefits to the non-categorical adults and families along with primary care. In my written testimony, I also handed each of you a coin. It's called a recovery coin. And a couple weeks ago, one of my counselors mentioned that without prompting, she had quite a number of clients dropping by months and years later and handing her their recovery coins. And there's a tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous that when you get a year or 2 years or 3 years, they have a group for you and they hand you one of these recovery coins. And so she handed me some of these. And each one of these coins represents a mother who's been able to take back her children from state care and raise them responsibly. They represent torn families where the heartbreak's been healed. They represent unemployable people who now have jobs and are paying taxes and therefore are helping us out of this Mount Everest that you find yourself on. They represent people with chronic criminal justice involvement who are now living honest lives. And they represent addicts who were committing suicide on the installment plan who are now contributing freely to their communities. By any objective measure, untreated addiction is one of the key drivers of social service, medical, and criminal justice costs in our society. Addiction treatment is one of the most cost-effective and efficient tools we have for bringing down these real costs. With treatment, many of these addicts dramatically change their lives, going from costs to societies and their families, to taxpayers and valued employees and parents. What we see and what Mr. Cass alluded to is that eliminating the standards from OHP has largely eliminated state-funded addiction treatment in the state and is therefore a false economy. So where we're at right now, I'm summarizing quickly. Between October of 2002 and March 2003, there's a chart in the back, we have seen intakes to treatment drop by 48%, and we expect this trend to continue. In residential treatment, even though 24% of the beds in the system have been eliminated, we have seen our waiting list for treatment cut from 3 to 4 months to 1 week. What this means is that far fewer people who need treatment are accessing it. And these are the results that have already occurred. What is on the immediate horizon is that when the standards are no longer Medicaid eligible, many, if not most, of the residential treatment capacity in the state will be lost without saving the state any money. Since adult residential is largely funded through leveraging Medicaid dollars, eliminating the Medicaid eligibility of most people who access residential treatment will eliminate the majority of the funding. Access to key treatment services will continue to be cut off, especially for women who have lost their children and are trying to get them back, and for people involved in the criminal justice system. And there is a very real prospect that if nothing changes, if things stay as they are right now, the majority of the addiction field will disappear by this winter. So the summation is that basically chemical dependency is a very small part of the overall OHP budget. We're basically in Mary Lou Renton amongst the sumo wrestlers of healthcare. But despite our small size, we have profound impact on the social services and healthcare in the state. So with this, with a small extra expense, by including the chemical dependency, expanding the chemical dependency benefit to include the non-categorical adults and families, you can have this very broad and very positive impact. That would be it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tim Hartnett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Hartnett. I'm the executive director of CODA, Portland's oldest alcohol and drug treatment agency. I'm here today to testify in support of reestablishing a comprehensive alcohol and drug abuse treatment benefit within the Oregon Health Plan. As we all know, alcohol and drug abuse are a root cause, a contributing factor in virtually every health and social concern Oregonians face. Yet public policy has only just begun to recognize this reality. In baseball parlance, we keep whiffing on this one. The cost and impact of alcohol and drug abuse can be readily seen in rising health care costs, traffic fatalities, unemployment, poor work performance, work-related accidents, divorce, domestic violence, crime, juvenile delinquency, learning disabilities, teen pregnancy, psychiatric illness, child abuse, environmental hazards, and the list goes on. I think Senator Morissette, you once referred to this list as the shock and awe list. What we're really trying to get at is to echo what many have said before me, that the impact of alcohol and drug abuse can be felt throughout our society. People who suffer from alcohol and drug-related problems continue to be perceived of as a group of weak-willed individuals who will only get better when they see and understand the error of their ways. This fundamental stigma represents a critical element in understanding why we have made no meaningful progress in the war on drugs and why we still have 14 million Americans who are dependent on alcohol. And most importantly, why alcohol and drug abuse treatments are routinely given a second-tier status within health insurance policies. It is time for public policy to reflect what the American Medical Association and the U.S. Surgeon General have concluded, that individuals suffering from alcohol and drug-related problems are suffering from a medical condition. The treatment for alcohol and drug abuse is at least as cost-effective as treatments for other chronic conditions, and it is one which warrants a primary, not secondary, status within health insurance plans. Addictions cost Oregonians a lot more when left untreated. We spend millions on treatment of alcohol and drug-related hypertension, liver disorders, industrial industries, family abuse, and so on. Doctors see dramatic numbers of preventable disorders such as hepatitis C, fetal alcohol syndrome, traumatic spinal cord, and brain injuries. Columbia University has estimated that in 1999, medical expenditures from failure to treat addiction cost $300 billion. The physician leadership on national drug policy recently reported that untreated addiction costs six times more than heart disease, six times more than diabetes, four times more than cancer. Including treatment is not free, but excluding the coverage makes little financial sense. Not funding alcohol and drug treatment for non-categorical adults, as many before me have said, will lead to substantial expenditures rippling across multiple healthcare and social service systems. For example, as many have said, how will a TANF mother whose children enter the foster care system access treatment when she simultaneously loses her Oregon health plan benefits? What will be the cost for these children if they are permanently removed from the home? As families are pulled apart, what will be the cost to multiple publicly funded systems over time? How will we understand and justify the human and financial costs as the foster care system caseload swells with these cases? What will the special education needs be for these young people as they struggle to adjust? Questions such as these can be asked of countless other subgroups who are not part of the federally mandated populations for Medicaid. I strongly urge you to include alcohol and drug abuse treatment benefits for all the populations covered within the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you.
Mr. Davis, I would ask that if you have written testimony, that you summarize it for us in fairness of time to others.
Co-chairs and committee members, I'm Jeff Davis. I'm the administrator of the Marion County Health Department and also here as the vice president of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I don't want to duplicate what has already been said, but I do support two things that have been said. One is the reinstatement of mental health and chemical dependency benefits into the Oregon Health Plan. I also want to support what appears to be a focus on the medically needy and making sure that those individuals get care. I can tell you from our personal experience in the health department, there are some of the most disabled people that use lots of medication, and it's very, very difficult for them when they're not able to access that. One of the things that I think is mentioned by Barry Cass, and I just want to emphasize that, is the kind of interconnection between mental health chemical dependency services and other service systems. You've heard it talked about in terms of child welfare and good examples around child welfare. One of the issues that's really critical is that many of the parents of kids who are in child welfare or kids who are in the juvenile justice system are standard. They're not plus. And many of those individuals coming out of the jails who've been identified in the jail systems of having mental health or chemical dependency problems are standard, not plus. So we've got a group of folks who are really in need of care and who, when they come out, don't have access to that. What I've provided for you in my written testimony, and I want to refer just to two pages of that. It's some they're graphs, and I want to refer to two pages because I think they're interesting. They show, from the Marion County perspective, outpatient providers, some comparisons between plus and standard. And if you look on page 2 in the graph, when we talk about exceptional needs cases, we're talking about those that need intensive care, those in risk of hospitalization, or those who may be in danger of self or others. And if you'll notice under that, the standard people, as noted earlier in Barry Cass' testimony, tend to use more medication. So that tells you something about their need. If you go to page 3, which really gives you some perspective on issues related to thought disorder, mood issues, anxiety they may have, various kinds of personality issues, you can see again that the standard, when you do the comparison between the two, show lots of problems in these areas. And so we tend to think of the plus and truly are disabled, but the standard population have many of the same problems, many of the same conditions that our plus population do. And then the last one that I want to show you is on page 5, the graph on page 5. And in our system, we look at those that have the fewest kind of needs to the highest needs. So when you see level 1, that's kind of the fewest needs. Level 2 is kind of in the middle of level 3. If you look at the percentage of how people fall out between standard and plus, and you look when you get again to the highest need, 16 and 10% breakdown, again, that's an example of the need of that particular population. Just in wrapping it up real quickly, two things that are disturbing to me in the system we currently have. I find it very distressing that people end up in the hospital, get treatment and get medication, and when they're discharged, they have nothing. When they come out of the hospital, there is no resources to cover their medication because, as Barry said, much of the grant money for indigent is gone. So now we're talking about no standard care. They get inpatient hospital psychiatric care. There's real concern I've heard in our system here in Salem Hospital about what do they do when they get out and the risk of the hospital of not having a discharge plan. Well, there is no discharge plan because there's no services in the community. The second one I struggle with personally, and it's been mentioned a couple of times, is that our children and those children in child welfare get treatment and are eligible for treatment. But from my view, one of the things that makes those kids better is for their parents to get care, and yet their parents are on standard. So we have children in our juvenile justice system, we have children in our child welfare system who are eligible for treatment, and we can't get their parents in either for chemical dependency or mental health treatment to really bring that family back to where we all want them to be. So those are issues to me that lead me to conclude by saying I think it's very important for our communities, aside from the cost shifts, for families in our communities to be able to serve all members of a family who need treatment, not just one portion of the family. And with that, I will conclude.
Thank you for your testimony. I believe on deck, if they're ready, is Randy Savisto, and Jamie Schumann, Dan Perkins, and following the three of them will be Linda Williams, Thomas Jones, and Reverend Carolyn Palmer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Well, they're coming forward. I just need to apologize. I've got another committee in another room, so if I'm jumping back and forth more than usual, I apologize. So.
Your apology is accepted.
Thank you.
Randy.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Randall Sorvisto, and I'm a recovering heroin addict, and I'm also a co-chair in the Recovery Association Project. I also work in the addictions field. I work as a recovery mentor. I work with people at their very early stages of coming out of a detox. I work with standard and plus clients. And most of all, I'm here to share as a consumer. I am an ex-consumer of Oregon Health Plan. I am a product of what the Oregon Health Plan had done for me. I went to treatment my first time in 1995. And I was fresh out of prison. I had no idea what was going on, the dysfunction. I didn't know how to live out here. And I learned some things in treatment. And one of those things was the difference between trying to live a functional life and living a dysfunctional life and thinking that was the only way to live. And I learned quite a few things there. Today, you know, I've been clean and sober for 6 years, and I've been working full time for 6 years. I've paid taxes for 6 years, and I voted yes on Measure 2648 in Multnomah County, and I'm really concerned for some of the money that's going on in Multnomah County. That when a single male or a single mother that lost her children to CSD tries to access treatment in order to address their problem to get their children back, and they cannot access treatment if there's no standard Oregon Health Plan. I respect the testimony that was given here before, but you know, I'm here as a consumer, and I want to appeal to the human element in this. You know, there's going to be a lot of other repercussions in emergency rooms, in our jails, and I'm sure you've heard it all, but most of all, I want to say that I'm in support of the Oregon Health Plan standard and also the medical needy. You know, we're really on to something, and we've built some systems in Portland, and we've built some systems in the A&D field that are there perpetuating, and they're getting better, and a lot of people are getting clean and getting their lives together. And at this point, with the Oregon Health Plan ending, it's going to undermine a lot of work that we have done and you have done. So I'm really in support of the Oregon Health Plan, and I hope that my speaking here today will have an effect.
Thank you very much.
My name is Jamie Schumann. I'm also a family mentor for Central City Concern. I'm also a mother, wife, friend, daughter, and a recovering addict. I have written testimony, and I'll do my absolute best to summarize and keep it short. I grew up on the East Coast in an upper-middle-class family, went to private schools, and at 17 years old was well on my way to becoming a low-bottom heroin addict. By 19, I was completely disowned by my family and had no life skills and no idea how to support anyone or anything except for my ever-growing drug habit. At 23, I came to Portland, Oregon without money, food, or clothing in a desperate effort to find relief from my disease and found Hooper Detox. The staff there told me about a program called the Oregon Health Plan. It was with OHP that I was able to find hope that I would not spend the rest of my life on the streets. Over the next 4 years, I completed 3 treatment centers and 4 detoxes. My battle with addiction was the greatest thing I'd ever fought. It was in those treatment centers and detoxes that I learned something every time I made a decision to try to change my life. However, without medical assistance, these opportunities for treatment may not have existed. On July 24, 2000, at 26 years old, I was admitted into Hooper Detox barely alive. My liver no longer functioned as it had been destroyed by hepatitis B and hepatitis C. I had mono, and my blood had thinned to the consistency of water because of the medication I took for blood clots. Most addicts never have had the time to learn life skills, such as going to the doctor, dentist, paying bills, eating well, or maintaining their health. In July of 2000, it was a clinic doctor who took me to the hospital. I would have never gone myself because I didn't know how. It was because of state medical insurance that I was able to see that doctor. In 1998, my oldest daughter was born Hep C positive, and over the years, I learned how to care for her, take her to doctor checkups, and get her viral count tested. In 2001, my husband was able to receive life-saving medication, interferon, while on the Oregon Health Plan. We could have never afforded it otherwise. Today, my entire family is hepatitis C free. Today, I pay taxes, have a home, have both of my children, a car, and work with other families whose parents are recovering from their own addictions. Today, I come before you to beg to let others have the chance that I was given. I personally am willing to do whatever I can, pay whatever I can afford, and journey however far for others to have even a portion of the opportunity that I was given to get clean. This month is my last receiving benefits from the Oregon Health Plan, and I am now financially prepared to maintain insurance for my family at my job. Society's struggle with addiction is far from over. Addicts die from this disease every minute. Let's collectively put the same effort into saving addicts' lives that we put into all other life-threatening illnesses. Please allow Oregon to be a positive example for the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dan.
My name is Dan Perkins, and 32 years old, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And mine's real short, sweet, and simple. Not more than 3 years ago, I was a heroin addict living on the streets, homeless, jobless, lying, cheating, and stealing to make ends meet. And most of all, I was hopeless. And when there was no one else around and nothing there, Oregon Health Plan was there, because I went to Hooper Detox, and I learned I could get some treatment through the Oregon Health Plan. And so I was able to do that. And I was able to stabilize as far as, you know, staying off the drugs, finding a way to, you know, hang around people that knew how to stay off drugs and alcohol. And today I believe the Oregon Health Plan saved my life. And for that I'm eternally grateful. It gave me a chance, like I said, it gave me a chance when nothing else did. As an addict, you know, I'm just like the person who isn't an addict. I got a child, a family, cost of living, and today I'm able to meet the cost of living and be a part of and participate with my family and my daughter, and I believe I've made good on, you know, using the Oregon Health Plan. Today I got two jobs, I pay taxes. I'm a positive influence in the community, but it's not just about what the Oregon Health Plan's done for me. You know, it's also given my parents their son back. It's given my employer a good employee. It's given the neighborhood a good neighbor. But more importantly than that, it's given my daughter her dad back. And so I'm here because I believe that we have to make this thing work. Thanks.
Randy, Jamie, and Dan, we want to thank you, and we appreciate your courage in coming here to share with us today. And thank you to your daughter.
Ashley Rose.
Hi, Ashley Rose. Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Williams and Thomas Jones and Reverend Carolyn Palmer. And on deck is Janine Delaney. And then Alan Lowe. Is that Alan? Oh, this is Alan. Okay. Lynn Marie Crider and Marcia Kelly and Alan Lowe will be with Janine. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda Williams, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Health Plan. I am a recovering heroin addict. I was an addict in active addiction for 33 years, and at the point that my life was gone, my children were gone, and that there was nothing left of myself or my life, I was able, through the Oregon Health Plan, also to go through Hooper Detox, to utilize patient care at PACT, to go through the mentor program, to I've been clean 2.5 years, transition into clean and sober housing. Today I'm a productive member of society. I work. I pay my taxes. I've given back what was given to me. I'm an example of a parent today. I have my children in my life. Though they're grown, today I'm able to be a different example and be a productive member of society. And I could not have done this without the help. I needed, when I was ready to do something different with my life, the resources available needed to be available to me to make that change. I could not do it on my own. And I just appreciate you looking into this and help make the changes that affect our community as a whole. Thanks.
My name is Tomas Jones. I'm a recovering addict of 2.5 years after using for 33 years. If it wasn't for the Oregon Health Plan, today I wouldn't be sitting in front of you. I wouldn't have the opportunity of having a job. I still collect the Oregon Health Plus because I also suffer from a mental illness. Up until 2.5 years ago, I'd never had a job in my life. And now I've been working for the same company for a little over 20 months. And because of that, I can pay taxes. I can also be a father to my youngest son who suffers from a mental illness and also a drug addiction. And if it wasn't for the Oregon Health Plan, there would be no way that I could get him into treatment today. I hope you make a decision today to keep the Oregon Health Plan and support the A&D on the Oregon Health Plan, because I think that's the only way you're going to keep drug-addicted people off the street. Thank you.
Reverend Palmer.
Good day to all of you, co-chair, Senator Winters, and the rest of you. I'm glad to be here today. I'm here from Special Concerns Ministries Public Policy Director, and also as a Multnomah County In-Home Care Advisory Committee Legislative Representative and the 504 Disability Board of the Housing Authority of Portland. I wanted to talk to you in particular about... Here's the chair over here, Jenny.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Where was I? In-home care, the medical needy Title 19 community-based waiver program, as you've known it. I'm not sure how, you're probably very familiar with it, but in case you're not, includes where the Medicare and any supplement insurance to Medicare premiums are being paid, and where you have the prescription coverage, where you have medical transportation, where you have the some of the co-pays or the bills that are need to be covered by treatments, diagnosis, those kind of things are covered. Also, I'm here because I want to see these remain. And one of the biggest concerns that has been brought to my attention is in the House Bill 3624, where there was discussion about managed care.
We're going to hear that later. Today we're going to deal with prioritization of the population.
Okay. Then I want to say that I see the need to increase back to level 14 in mobility. I say that because of some of the people that I'm dealing with who were in 12 and no longer have eligibility, neither do some of those that's in 14, and they're not making it on their own. Some of them have re-injured themselves, or their illness has caused a flare-up in such a way that they are forced into a higher level of care, or like a nursing home or foster care, things like that. So I'd really like to see we restore to the level 14, and to keep with the Oregon Health Plan Plus the items I just named earlier, as a very important factor. Some of these people are choosing between paying the rent or paying for their prescriptions, life-sustaining prescriptions, and for some it's not possible. Being a minister, I want to say from the church perspective that even, especially the smaller churches, are not able to even maintain one person who maybe their expense is $400 a month on to $800, and they just can't do it. And so and I'm also here for the medical needy. There are some people who have heart congestion failure and other life-threatening illnesses who were on the medical needy program who are not. These are people who are not receiving over, say, $605 a month, and they no longer have their medical transportation. And with the heart conditions, it's very hard for them to be tried to transport by bus to St. Vincent's Hospital or wherever they're receiving treatment. So again, I want to ask you to consider seriously restoring the medical needy that would, I see by fair standards, you can't just pick the people who are the most critically ill from multiple conditions, but there are many out there. And so one man that's 45 years old who is a paraplegic with multiple conditions. So there's these kind of conditions, and so I ask you to restore. As far as revenues, are you hearing that part now?
We're actually into populations and benefits, but I think I know what you're going to say. So I think we're hearing your message.
Does that mean I'm not supposed to say it?
Well,
I just want to say the Revenue Coalition, I would seriously consider those. And I do want to say from the public, we're hearing very strongly that sales tax this time, but designated for health care of these kind of conditions, and that they would feel like the money's going where it's needed, and they'd be willing to do that for those reasons.
Thank
so,
you very
thank
much.
You.
And a special thank you for your courage to come and share with us your recovery. Janine and Alan Lowe, Lynn Marie Kreider, Marcia Kelly. Hi, Janine. Yes, I am. I know that you have an appointment, so we're going to take you first. Can you bring the microphone up a little bit to her? Okay, there you go.
Thank you, Senator Winters, committee. For the record, my name is Janine Delaney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Disabilities Commission to talk about prioritization of populations and services packages for the Oregon Health Plan. I guess I want to echo some of the things said earlier, but I'll be brief. I think it's our job to determine what the needs are, the health, basic health care needs of Oregonians are, to figure out the services that will meet those needs, and then find a way to pay for those. And I'm, and the commission, I think, is terribly worried that if we go about it the other way, which is to set a cap and then somehow figure out how to either get some people in and some people out or try to pare down services, that's really not a very good way to go about things, and that it in fact doesn't do what the Oregon Health Plan was designed to do, which is to provide a basic health care package for Oregonians that need that health care and to do it in the most cost-effective way. Citizens decided years ago with the health plan that's what they wanted to do. And I think to ask to prioritize who is more needy or who is more deserving of a particular health care benefit it's not a possible question to answer, let alone a good question to even have to ask, I think. I, too, am hearing from people about the importance of restoring the medically needy program for citizens who cannot afford medications. I want to speak to one of the programs that Tina Kitchen mentioned, the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program. It's a program that actually helps people with disabilities be employed so that they can pay taxes and contribute, but still maintain their health care benefits and also, more importantly, their Medicaid long-term care benefits so that they can be provided attendant care and other services while they're working and being contributing members. So if that program goes away, not only do they lose those critical services, but they're no longer employed and they're no longer paying taxes and contributing to their community. I also think that each service under the health plan is linked to another. So to say that one is more important, again, is difficult. It's important that we pay for prescription drugs. It's important, as you heard from the just phenomenal testimony, to pay for mental health and chemical dependency services. You know, without dental care, nutrition can be compromised and very bad health outcomes happen. Without vision care, sight gets impaired. Not only are you risking quality of life issues, but safety is a factor. Not everybody can function with limited vision. It's something you learn to do. OT, PT, the therapies, speech therapy, all of those are essential if people who suffer from catastrophic illnesses or accidents are to return to work, return to their families, return to their communities. So I guess I'm here to say, again, I think we need to consider revenue to fund these services. And my commission really just couldn't prioritize and say that somebody with a disability was more needy than a pregnant mom, or somebody, you know, a six-year-old child needed more than somebody else. We just couldn't do it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Lowe.
Co-chairs and members of this special committee on the Oregon Health Plan. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I testify today on behalf of the low-income Oregonians who come to the Oregon Food Bank and to the Oregon Law Center for assistance. These Oregonians have negligible disposable income. We ask you to examine the financial capacity of the Oregon Health Plan members to participate in the cost sharing, particularly the premiums. Nearly 50% of the adults on standard are below 25% of the federal poverty level. Folks seeking a semblance of stability in their lives place a premium, their priority, on having a roof over their head, that all-important address. We believe the decrease in the standard Oregon Health Plan enrollment is another indication of the lack of ability to pay. The relatively healthy ones may opt to go bare. The premiums really become a denial of access for many. The standard folks choosing to stay with the Oregon Health Plan are very likely the ones with chronic illnesses. Their profile is not the same as that of the non-categoricals before the advent of Plus and Standard. This is leading to adverse selection, which needs to be reflected in the capitation rates. The rate should accommodate these challenges so the patients can be served with coordinated care in their local areas. The Oregon Health Plan faces another related fiscal crisis, and that involves questions about the adequacy of reimbursement to providers. Providers were assured in Senate Bill 27 that their compensation would be fair. It hasn't been. This has discouraged participation by a growing number of physicians and plans. You can have the most comprehensive benefit package ever designed, but it is an empty gesture if there are no providers available to offer the health services. Most of the optional benefits, according to federal law, are not really optional within Oregon norms. We'd like to highlight dental services because it is so frequently discussed as an add-on, as something separate. We don't view the mouth as separate from our bodies. Dental care is health care. We support dental coverage for all the served populations. And I'd like to add, as a member of the Health Services Commission, having conducted hearings on this going back to 1989, when you hear from the public, dental service is always one of those priorities that comes forward. Mental health and chemical dependency services are also essential benefits of a health care plan. As you've heard today, these services are really linked to our obligation as a state to work with families toward reunification. And I might add that the conditions calling for these treatments are part of the Oregon Health Plan prioritized list. While you will be specifically addressing the healthcare delivery system when you consider House Bill 3624, we ask that you think of where benefits can be most appropriately delivered to the populations covered by the Oregon Health Plan. To us, that means adequately supporting the existing safety net clinics, school-based health centers, and urgent care facilities. In many areas of the state, there is a need for new ones. The working Oregonians who are part of the Oregon Health Plan often find it financially difficult to address health services during their work hours. We believe extended hours for primary care will lower the avoidable cost shift to hospital emergency rooms. If you choose to narrow the Oregon Health Plan benefits for the non-categoricals to a primary care package, it becomes even more important to have this local primary care safety net in place. We wish to remind you that Oregon includes the general assistance population with the federal mandatory group, the categoricals. These are Oregonians who have less than $50 to their name, $1,500 in resources, and have a disability of at least a year in duration. The fragile health status of these Oregonians dictates their continuing presence with the Oregon Health Plan Plus population, the mandatory group. Oregon voters in two separate plebiscites have reaffirmed the Oregon Health Plan. We do believe that level of support continues to exist. You can consider those elections as a health care mandate for Oregonians living in poverty. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia, before you begin your testimony, I want to call the next group that's on deck, and that's Lisa Colbus, Maddie Barbers, Babkus, and Bill Tolan.
Thank you. Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Our members include the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, Oregon's Older Women's League, Delta Kappa Gamma, Oregon's National Organization for Women, the Salem YWCA, and the American Association of University Women of Oregon. Thank you for letting us come and testify before you today. Our membership numbers in the thousands. AUW alone has over 3,000 members. For AUW, the only membership requirement is a college degree. I say that because some people think that we're only women associated with the university system, and that's not true. And we also have men. We have members for WRC and NISN, Grants Pass, and Seaside, to name a few places. They care about the future of Oregonians because my salary is totally funded by donations and small membership fees. I come before you today troubled that we are asked to set priorities for coverage. We are asked to advocate for pregnant women and children. We all know that the success of a child in many societies is based on the health and the education of the mother. Our children need to be healthy to be able to participate in education and become full participating members of society. But should that priority rank over the priority of an elderly widow who raised a family, cared for an aged spouse or parent? Do we eliminate her from coverage only to end up paying a higher price in long-term or emergency care? Our organizations would suggest that the priorities that this body should be working toward are the priority of funding services. We should not be setting one population against the other. We should be finding all available resources and then leveraging those resources for federal dollars. Our priority should be in assuring Oregonians that we can all read the inscription on the front of the building and act upon that inscription. I see it every day as I walk into the Capitol. And it is, a free state is maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and the sharing of benefits justly appointed. And I do again thank you again, and I remember to look at that every day when I walk into the Capitol. Thank you.
Lynn Marie.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Marie Kreider. I'm research director at the Oregon AFL-CIO. I had the unenviable opportunity to serve on the waiver application steering committee that did a process very much like what you're doing now a couple of years ago when we designed the OHP standard benefit plan. At the Oregon AFL-CIO, we recognize that these are tough fiscal times for Oregon, but the state budget's in trouble because many Oregonians are in trouble, and it distresses us that we would consider reducing or pushing people out of the safety net at that the Oregon Health Plan is at exactly the time that they especially need it. And so we share with some of the other speakers today in urging you to ask those of us, like myself, who are paid as much this year as I was last, to step forward to assist those who don't have jobs and qualify right now for the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan was created so that we would stop rationing people, and we would urge you to find a way to provide basic benefits to all people who are currently covered in the Oregon Health Plan. Turning to the question of prioritizing benefits, we would like to say the same with respect to benefits, that is, that the Health Services Commission has done a job of thinking carefully about how we provide cost-effective health services to Oregonians, and that we shouldn't really be trying to lay a whole different system of prioritizing benefits on top of that. That said, I want to make some specific comments, recognizing that you may have to do some things that we would not like to do in the area of benefits. I think we've learned something by what happened when we created the OHP standard benefit. We created a substandard benefit, and we did it by, rather than deciding what benefits were less essential than others, which was the old prioritized list methodology, we imposed cost sharing on the folks in the OHP standard population by increasing premiums and levying copays. Many of the folks on that plan were so poor that, frankly, it wasn't rational for them to pay a premium unless they were already so desperate for services that they had to have them. So that what we did is push people off of the OHP standard program, and so we've seen a decline of about 10% in enrollment in that program, and I think it's because of the way that we designed that package. So I don't want to suggest to you, and we made it worse when we cut mental health and chemical dependency out of that package and still ask them to pay the same kinds of premiums for that program. So I would say we should not continue OHP standard in the form that it is right now. We should re-examine that question. Ideally, we would eliminate the two-tier structure of the health plan that we have now. But if we don't have the resources to do that, we do need to design a benefit package for adults that meets their most pressing needs. That means that everyone under 100% of poverty should have a primary care benefit that includes preventive care of all kinds, including mental health and chemical dependency services. It's also critically important, we believe, that there be no premiums for that primary benefit package, and that the co-pays be very small. Otherwise, we will continue to find that low-income people make the decision that they can't afford health care, even though we theoretically have a program for them. The primary care benefit package that was costed by staff and reported to you yesterday, I guess it was, is not the kind of primary benefit package that we believe you should adopt, because it retains the problematic premium and copay structure of OHP standard while further diminishing the benefits that people would get for that program. We do support the concept of the primary care benefit package, that is, the decision to save money by not covering hospitalization for adults. But we believe that you need to make those preventive care services, those outpatient services, those primary care services truly available to people. And we think that the experience that we've heard reported from the safety net suggests that people will pay, they'll scrape together somehow, the money they need to make a small copay when they go to get services, particularly if the clinic will work with them on how to pay that. But the premiums truly are a barrier to services that we need to eliminate in a primary care benefit package.
Senator Brown has a question.
Question for either Lynn Marie or Ellen, and I guess, so on the whole premium conversation, I guess my question would be, isn't something better than nothing? And then secondly, the dental community has come forward with an emergency package for the adult standard population that would require $2 premium. Essentially, we can leverage it with federal dollars at pretty minimal state costs. Doesn't that make sense? So I'd like you to respond to both of those.
I think the premium costs probably, this is a very ballpark, but I think premium is maybe 10%, would be about 10% of the cost of the package. Now, that's 10% of the total package, including the, am I right, Ellen? Maybe she can speak to that. But I think we're talking about eliminating the premium would up the cost, the total cost in general fund and federal dollars by about 10%. If that premium is truly a barrier to people getting services, I don't think it's worth doing. I think we should find someplace else to generate that revenue. Respecting the premium for dental services, I don't know. I don't know whether a $2 premium is worth collecting, frankly. But perhaps Ellen has more to say on that.
I applaud the dentists for co-chairs, Senator Brown. I applaud the dentists for their continuing effort to try to come up with some services. But as I went back and looked at what they had done within their revamping of really narrowing the treatments within for the plus population, it seemed to me that those same services, which certainly there's nothing cosmetic in anything they have there, that those same services need to be there for the standard population as well. Premiums, as it is structured in the standard plan, where they these very, very low, almost no income Oregonians having to pay on a monthly basis becomes so very difficult. And I would echo what Lynn Marie said, because I know in our work with safety net clinics, I became very, very convinced that paying at the time of service was far easier for folks. They were then more likely to come in a timely way. Someone who is relatively healthy, who has just enough income to pay the rent, is going to look at paying a health care premium as somewhat problematic. In our previous setup, they had at least 6 months, those who had to pay a premium, to make it up. Now, with the monthly basis for folks where even an address is problematic, it's very difficult.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Courtney?
Lemire, you said primary preventive care package, no premium. Did you make that statement?
That's what I think would work, yes.
Give me an example of what is that? What is in that package?
Well, I think what was costed for the other day has the right set of benefits. That it is, it has physician services, it has mental health,
that's
chemical dependency. I'm sorry.
So, is that an incentive package? Am I interpreting this wrong? This is not an incentive package in terms of certain lifestyle choices.
No, no. I'm saying basically what you had costed the other day was a set of benefits that for adults, the non-mandatory population of adults, which would not cover hospitalization but would cover a lot of the preventive services. I think that's the right idea. What I think I would change about what was costed for you is I would eliminate the premium and maintain point of service cost sharing.
Okay. John.
Senator Minnis.
Yeah, Lynn Marie, I wanted to get some clarification on FLCIO and their position here. I'm trying to understand when your organization in Oregon issues a letter like you've done and make comments with respect to public policy. Is this something that your union membership has actually voted on?
No, our union membership elects their leadership, and I, as staff, work with the leadership to develop policy and response, like on a one-day turnaround time as we have.
This is not something the actual membership of the FLCIO has actually voted on and said, yay, yes, we do or no, we don't agree.
No, sir. We have our leadership, and by our leadership, I mean our executive board, which includes representatives of some 50 of our largest unions, did set health care as a priority and did say that maintaining a strong Oregon health plan was a priority objective. But no, the detail of the position that I've shared with you today is not something that our membership has voted
on. I'm just trying to get this straight in my head because I'm a member of the Portland Police Association, and they so far have not taken a stand in a general framework like this. In fact, they're at this juncture trying to figure out how they're going to get health care for their own membership. So I'm very much interested in how the FLCIO comes about with broad-based policy decisions like this and what the membership actually says about it as opposed to the executive board.
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, basically the philosophy that we have about this is that our organization has taken a stand in favor of covering everybody with health care and strengthening the Oregon health plan.
Another question, but Lynn Marie, I understand what you're telling me, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with it, but you suggest, as others do, that revenue be raised to cover these expenses. So the assumption is that your membership would pay a portion of that. And so the subsequent logical question is, has your membership actually voted on whether or not they support or do not support increasing taxes or payroll taxes or some other funding mechanism for this purpose. It's germane to the issue. It's important to me because I actually introduced a broad-based employer tax for this purpose.
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, we did at our last convention pass a resolution that laid out, and I can share it with you, the importance of adopting a stronger system of taxation and funding of public services, and I'd be glad to share that with you when particular tax options come open. For example, the recent levy in Portland, our labor council acted unanimously in support of that. So I think we're...
Madam Chair, if I could, Limerick, is that something your council does, the executive board does, or is it the AFL-CIO membership that's doing it?
We are a representative body. We do not run plebiscites of... within
you don't ask your membership what
our, they elect their representatives, well, which come to conventions every other year and that meet every other month to establish the policy direction for our organization.
My union actually asks the membership.
Perhaps you and Ms. Kreider can get together and discuss this, and we'll get and have your discussion. Thank you for your testimony. And Lisa and Maddie and Bill are next, and on deck. If this is confusing, it's because we want to make certain that those who come a long distance and those who have some urgency, that we're making sure that they're being heard. And on deck is David Eisen, Gary Cobb, and Jim Wittenberg.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Colbus. I'm a citizen of Eugene, Oregon, and I am a part-time instructor at Lane Community College. I want to thank each of you for this opportunity to speak to you regarding the elimination of the Employed Persons with Disabilities program. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a 31-year-old single woman who has resided in Oregon for most of my life. I'm currently employed part-time teaching psychology at Lane Community College, teaching one class per term, and I have been teaching there for the last 6 years. In 1990, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my mental illness soon took on a life of its own. By 1991, I was severely and dangerously depressed. This severe depression lasted 5 years, required 7 hospital stays, and 13 electroconvulsive shock treatments. In 1993, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which is a chronic disease characterized by chronic and unrelenting body-wide pain, extreme exhaustion, and extremely poor sleep. I have been experiencing chronic pain since childhood. Sometimes my pain is so intense that even the most potent painkillers, those used to treat cancer, do not work. This past March, I was again hospitalized for severe depression. I hadn't eaten regularly for a month. I was sleeping 18 hours a day and couldn't bathe myself regularly. I couldn't pay my bills because I couldn't fill out a check. My friends were asking when I was planning to kill myself. In a sick blessing, my internist realized that it was my pain medication that was making me so violently depressed. I was hospitalized to detox off that drug in a safe environment and was there for 2 weeks. I have recovered fully from that experience, but have had to take a term off from work to recover from my illness and from the detox experience. Because of my chronic pain disease and mood disorder, I depend very much on my care provider to help me with health needs and in home. It is impossible for me to do all of the shopping, laundry, cleaning, and errand running necessary for living a normal life. Doing laundry for 2 hours exhausts me for the rest of the day, as does grocery shopping and other errands. It is much too painful for me to mop or vacuum, to clean the shower, or to reach and clean things above my head. I cannot lift things, and I can't stand on some days for more than 5 minutes at a time. There are days where I am in too much pain to drive safely. I'm also on 13 to 15 medications on any given day. The side effects of these can make driving impossible for me. In addition, it's not unusual for me to require 12 to 14 hours a day to sleep, just in order to function. And I wake up with migraines every day. It is only with the help of the EPD program that I have been able to keep teaching part-time. The EPD program provides me both with medical benefits and the help of an in-home care provider 5 hours a week. I cannot survive the cuts to the EPD program. I have been managing a chronic pain disease and bipolar disorder for 13 years. My monthly medical expenses, which include prescription drugs at $850 to $1,000 a month, and my visits to my chronic pain specialist, allergist, psychiatrist, psychologist, and my in-home health care provider, are beyond my monthly income of $1,400 a month. Unfortunately, I have no family in this area, and my father just lost his job of 33 years at United Airlines. There is no way for my family to help me with my health needs. I am a lucky person to be loved by many, but my health needs are simply too overwhelming for my friends. They care deeply, and they do fill in when my care provider cannot, but frankly, they have children and parents of their own to care for. Finally, should I lose my medical coverage and my care provider, I will no longer be able to work. And I believe somebody discussed that there was a population that needs the EPD program in order to afford to go to work. Without pain medication, I cannot work. I will have to quit my job in order to care for myself. And if I have to quit my job, it will cost you much more. It will cost the state of Oregon much more to care for my needs, because without my medications, I will be in the hospital again. And I will be costing to other social services. I am amazed that I am at risk of losing everything, my job, my home, and my medical care, everything because of the current proposed cuts to the EPD program. After all, I did everything right. I studied hard, completed graduate school, didn't use or abuse drugs, and I didn't get pregnant at 14. I make a significant contribution to my community, both as a teacher and a volunteer. But I did get sick with two illnesses that are beyond my ability to control. Finally, here's what I really don't understand. Those of us on the EPD program pay in towards our care. I pay $198.30 a month towards my health expenses, as well as paying state income taxes and co-pays for medication and medical care. My question for you is, why are you cutting more from Medicaid when over 30 corporations in Oregon pay only $10 a year in state taxes? Thank you for your time.
Meg.
Mine is very short and I hope sweet, and I appreciate the opportunity for speaking. My name is Maddie Babkes. I'm a widow with four children. I'm here representing my son, Joseph Babkes. He's a young adult with developmental disabilities. He was 9 when his father died. He receives Social Security death benefits, not SSI, even though he is developmentally disabled. He has had to find his own private health insurance since he was 18. He's been on the EPD program since last August. He works 15 hours a week. His hours were cut recently so that they wouldn't have to pay for his medical benefits, or so that he wouldn't qualify for any benefits. Essentially, he works to pay his insurance premium, his premium is $224.30, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a math whiz to figure out 15 hours a week times minimum wage. He's pretty much living to pay his insurance. Unemployment is not an option because he still wouldn't receive SSI, as the powers that be in Social Security will not switch him over to SSI. He would always remain until his dying day on Social Security death benefits. I am a self-employed small business owner, and I only have I myself only have catastrophic health insurance. If Joe loses his insurance, he will again have to find private health insurance, or rather, I will have to find him other insurance. This is difficult and very time-consuming. He does have a pre-existing health condition. Please keep in mind, he pays $224.30 a month for his insurance. He doesn't get it for free. And just as an aside, on Memorial Day, I'm also from Eugene, I was going into work in the middle of the day, and under the Willamette River Bridge sat two radar cops. One, and I pulled over just because I was curious as to what two of them were doing. And one had the radar gun, and the other one was chasing the criminal who was going 5 miles over the speed limit. I personally don't understand why we need two radar cops. And I can't understand why we can't re-budget somewhere, somehow, so that my son and others who pay into this insurance will not lose their benefits. And thank you for listening.
Thank you. I do have a question, and I'll talk to you later, because I would like to explore why he can't shift from one benefit to the other one. So
I can tell you in one sentence. I have been over this with every, I went to Peter DeFazio's office and consulted with a Social Security specialist, and she said, you'd be wasting your time in pursuing this any further, because Social Security will not change him from SSD to SSI because they don't want another person on the welfare rolls.
I still would like to talk to you, see if we can. That's absurd. Anyway, go ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for letting me come here today to speak. my name is Bill Tolan. I'm a leader for the Recovery Association Project Mid-Valley, representing Salem, Oregon. I'm also a student, full-time student at Chemeketa Community College. I'm also a recovering addict. I work in the Disability Service Office at Chemeketa. That's my work-study job. I'm just here to speak in support of OHP. Because of Oregon Health Plan, I was allowed, as a recovering addict, to participate in programs that helped me get my life back. I'm currently a client of Department of Corrections. Because of the OHP cuts, I'm not allowed to do addiction, anything that has to do with A&D. I have to pay for that myself. And I don't have the money to do that because I'm a full-time student and I'm on grants, which is the only income I have, and my federal work study right now. Because of the cuts in OHP, I have no optical and I have no dental. And there's a mentors program here in town which has helped me with transportation, but I was supposed to do go in and have an assessment, drug assessment, when I was released from prison. I didn't have the money to do that because of the mentors program. My volunteering for that, they waived that. But I should be in alcohol and drug treatment right now, which I'm not, because I can't afford it. I just came here today to speak my piece and let you guys know that because of the cuts in the Oregon Health Plan, there's people that are recovering addicts that do need those programs, and especially the mothers and the fathers that have children that are trying to get their lives back in order, and they're not able to do that without the alcohol and drug treatment which OHP affords. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Thank all three of you. Next is David Eisen. Gary Cobb and Jim Wittenberg, and on deck is Mary Lou Heinrich and Amy Robin. Go ahead and begin.
Okay, we're waiting.
We're waiting for Jim.
Well, I see we're at the end of the program again, so a good number.
No, you're not anywhere near the end.
I'm not.
No.
I'm looking around.
I have the list stacked up.
I was
this
looking
high.
Around for some of your colleagues. There she comes. Okay. All right.
You're waiting for me.
Specifically, Madam Chairperson and Chair and members of the committee. I know most of you. I guess Senator Fisher would be the only senator that I haven't had the honor of meeting so far. And you're from my hometown in Roseburg, so my stepmother and brother still live there. So we'll get to talk.
I have four individuals.
Yeah, well,
I'm
going to introduce one of them along with him. I'm going to have to leave because I've got a psychiatry appointment. I need to. I scheduled it right after this hearing.
I need to have my record straight,
okay.
Jim. So
I'll give you that name in a moment. So, okay. Essentially, what I wanted to respond to is just two things, and then I'm going to introduce these people and leave because I've got an appointment at 5:45 in Portland. As a pharmacist for 37 years, I want to respond to the premium part. As working both in Washington State and in Oregon, I can't tell you how many hundred times I've had people come up to the counter with a $3 to $5 copay that turned around and walked away because they didn't have $3 to $5 to pay. And I can't tell you how many times that pharmacists like myself have paid that $3 or that $5 so a young person or a mother with some children could get their medication because they didn't have the $3 to $5. It may be insignificant to you folks up there and to me, you know, but $3 to $5 means a bus pass sometimes to get across town, or it means food for that day, or it means something very important to them, like some more medication. And you are dissuading people from getting their prescriptions by these premiums, and it'd be large numbers that won't be getting them. Secondly, I've spent most of the morning, and I'm real tired because I've been trying to call the pharmaceutical people back in the East Coast. I've been trying to get hold of Pfizer and Park Davis for a friend of mine who's not able to get his on the Medically Needy program, who's not able to get his drugs right now. And
Jim, I'm going to keep you to your 3 minutes,
okay.
Please.
Okay.
Thank you.
I know that. I understand. You always do. So, the thing I just want to tell you is that I'd like to see that you could help me get a number for this company called Pfizer Laboratories. They seem to have their toll-free number and their pharmacy assistance number disconnected. Now, maybe they didn't pay their bills this month or something, but we can't reach them to get the medications for Rich Kibbins and others. And I'm sad to say that if I can't reach them, many others probably can't either. But Rich has congestive heart failure and diabetes, and without those medications, I guarantee you he will die. And so I think that the Medically Needy program is very important. So I'd like to tell you that David Eisen is here. Dr. David Eisen is clinical director for the Central City Concern. They house, treat chemical addiction and alcoholism. They provide job creation and training. He oversees the medical operation of the entire treatment program. I'm certain that you'll benefit from his wise counsel. I'd like you also to meet Bobby TSOW. He's a recovering addict and a longtime guest of the Oregon prison system. He's probably more pleased than anyone else in this room to be testifying here today. Next, I'd like to introduce Lynn Founders to Gary Cobb. He's a co-chair of the Recovery Association Project. Mm-hmm. They return, return addicts and alcoholics as working, sustaining members to society who pay their own insurance premiums these days. And I'm very proud to know these three people. And I'd like to tell you that these are the kind of folks that I like to associate with these days. I have a lot more fun with them than I do with me here in the legislature. And this will be my last term down here. I'm retiring from pharmacy and from the legislature. I won't be here again, folks, so you won't have me around. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Robert Sow. Excuse me. My name is Robert Sow, and I'm a leader in the Recovery Association Project for Multnomah County. I'm also a recovering addict with 3 years clean. I'm employed with Central City Concern and work at the Portland Alternative Health Center as a relapse prevention counselor. I vote today and I pay taxes. I'm no longer utilizing the Oregon Health Plan and the many other life-saving services offered to the tens of thousands of people who otherwise may die without the opportunity to change and live a productive, self-sufficient life. I stand before you today, a product of the investment put into me through the Oregon Health Plan, and to share with you a part of my story and the figures in dollars of what has been done and what is being done. 4 years ago, I was costing the state of Oregon and the taxpaying citizens $24,750 to house me in prison for a year. While I was in prison, the cost to the state to house my four-year-old son in foster care was $10,450 per year. When I got out of prison, I got on the Oregon Health Plan and utilized the services available to me, such as alcohol and drug treatment and transitional housing for 1 year, which cost the state $4,000. The state's $4,000 investment in me through the Oregon Health Plan got in return a man who stands before you today with 3 years clean, a family reunited, and a man no longer involved with the Department of Corrections or Adult Family Services, a man who has paid back in full the $10,450 to Adult Family Services for caring for my child for that 1 year. I'm just one example of hundreds of successes that occur each and every year because of the Oregon Health Plan and its community-based partners. Your continued investment in people like me can save the state up to $31,200 a year. In closing, I'd like to say that your investment in the Oregon Health Plan is life-saving, life-giving, and the payoff is life-sustaining. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bobby. Good afternoon, Senate members, co-chair Winters. I have two sheets of paper that are in front of you, both with the heading. I'm sorry. My name is Gary Cobb. I'm a leader with the Recovery Association Project. And the first letter that's is pretty much my story, and this is what I want to share with you guys today. The second letter is an open invitation to the Senate committee in hopes that you will allow the Recovery Association Project to come and meet with you outside of this setting, more of a personal deal to kind of let you know that we're in this with you. We're on the same mountain with you. And with that, I want to go on with my story. And I also need to say that that the Oregon Health Plan CD benefits were that lifeline that pulled me out of that crevasse of addiction, you know, while we're on the subject of mountains. And I really am truly grateful with what was offered to me 3 years ago. So if you would like to read along with me, I'm going to read my story to you. I want to truly thank you for allowing me to be here today. I am a co-chair with the Recovery Association Project, and I am a tax-paying registered voter of the state of Oregon. That does not mean much 3 years ago. It means everything in the world today, and it means so much more to what I would like to summarize with my story, is that without these CD benefits, I would not be able to pay back the treatment that was offered me. I have with me all my check stubs that I've had over the last 2 years, and it's clearly written in black and white, my state taxes that I've paid back goes into the general fund. So what I'm saying to y'all is that what we got going on here with the CD package is a built-in revenue plan. It doesn't pay out right away, but you wait back, you know, give it 6 months, invest into it. That's what we have going on here. I know we need additional revenue, but we also need the standard plan restored. Because like Bobby spoke, he went through that, the same plan as I did, and several other individuals that spoke in front of you today. That's how we are the community of citizens that you want in your state. And I encourage you to please contact us outside this setting and let us work with you. We can get through this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, Senate Committee, thank you for allowing us to speak today. For the record, my name is David Eisen, and I'm the Clinical Director of Central City Concern Health Services and Recovery Services. We are a safety net clinic of what you've been hearing about today, and we're also an FQHC subrecipient, a federally qualified health center. We provide primary care, alcohol and drug treatment, psychiatric care, mental health care, mentoring, acupuncture services, and alcohol and drug-free housing for over 360 homeless people and low-income people on OHP standard a day. We treat over 3,000 unduplicated people people a year. That's over 10% of the 29,000 people that received chemical dependency and mental health services that Barracast spoke about earlier in the afternoon. We are quite familiar with not only the stories that you hear from Gary and Bobby today, but also from the other people that spoke earlier. And as Bobby said, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people a year that are benefiting from OHP standard because of income eligibility, that are turning their lives around, becoming productive members of our communities, not just in Portland, but in Salem, in Kaiser, in Eugene, in Bend, in Coos Bay. However, as we also heard earlier today, we are faced with the debacle of an unraveling of systems that have taken sometimes 15 to 20 years to build. In the space of 3 to 6 months, we will see many of those systems taken apart. Can we wait another 15 to 20 years to build them back as our children and as our children's children and generations find that they have none of the services that their parents and other people in their families were able to avail themselves? I'd just like to tell you, and you've heard the rest of it, I'd like to say that the Oregon Health Plan, both standard and plus, there needs to be accountability. And I can speak to you about the accountability from a program providing level and from an individual clinician level. We need to make sure that the people, the institutions that get OHP reimbursement have outcomes, have viable outcomes, and have measurable outcomes. As a taxpayer, and I'm willing to pay more taxes, by the way, when you all decide that, I'm willing to pay more taxes. I want to note that my money is going to somewhere that creates outcomes. In OHP standard land, at PAC in Central City Concern, we were designated one of the top 6 homeless clinics in the country by the Bureau of Primary Care last year. Feel good that the money that you're putting, that you're designating, be put in from the general fund into OHP standard, not only gets that federal match, but also gets outcomes that the state of Oregon can be very, very proud of. The only other thing that I'd like to point out is that represent Senator Minnis, and you were talking earlier about where was the buy-in from people. And it raised an interesting point. At PAC, we use an incentive plan for people to stop smoking, so the $3 to $4 that they pay for a package of cigarettes can actually go for their premiums. Now, in terms of their premiums, I don't know if you're aware of it, that if you miss one premium, you're off the health plan for 6 months. You can't even reapply. For somebody in the midst of chemical dependency treatment, mental health treatment, and or primary care for a chronic disease like diabetes, that is life-threatening. And from a ethical point of view in regard to continuity of care, we could actually be viewed as abandoning that patient, which becomes a liability to the clinic, which means then we have to start screening people based on that, which is an awful, terrible thing for us that value compassion here in the state of Oregon to have to undertake. I don't envy your positions. The decisions you have to make are not easy. However, I believe, as Gary stated earlier, that with partners like Central City Concern, like the Recovery Association Project, and some of the other people and organizations that you have heard speak earlier and that you will continue to hear speak this afternoon and tomorrow, I'm sure that we can come to some. I know, I'm not sure, I know that we can come to an answer for this for all of Oregon. Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thanks. David, 2 questions. How are you? And welcome.
Thank you.
Could you talk about what happened to your clients that were on the stand, that part of the standard that are no longer dependency? We have 7,500 who were on the medically needy program. So what happened to your clients?
Unfortunately, I can tell you what happened to some of them, Senator Brown. Some of them died. Some of them committed suicide. Some of them went back to the penitentiary because they were on parole and probation and could not access care, got active in their addiction again, and had to go back to $24,750 to house them with 3 hots and a cot because we couldn't pay for their premiums.
3 hots and a cot.
Yeah, I got it. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Good. Could you talk a little bit about acupuncture and its effectiveness in terms of dealing with drug and alcohol treatment?
Well, acupuncture actually is probably the most cost-effective medical intervention that you have available on the priorities list of CPT codes, of procedure codes for treating addictions as well as depression and anxiety. It's drug-free. You have in front of you outcomes and research that prove its effectiveness. People don't die from overdoses of acupuncture.
We'd like to try, though, right?
And it is something that can be put into a residential treatment setting, an outpatient treatment setting. It can be used in conjunction with drug option treatment, which we don't do at PAC or in any of the Central City Concern treatment settings. But it is now the standard of care. The Center for Substance Abuse Treatment is coming out with a tip next month stating that acupuncture should be employed in any outpatient drug treatment center that wants to look at treating homeless people and low-income folks. Thank you.
You and I have had this discussion.
Yes, ma'am.
On the effectiveness of acupuncture in treating it without having to use drugs. I do have a question of both gentlemen, and how many times were you in treatment before you finally were able to get to recovery?
Well, Chair Winters, that's a great question, and I can honestly answer that. This is my third time at going through treatment, and I didn't read my story. I kind of got nervous up here, but I wanted to mention to you that the last two treatment facilities that I went through back east offered treatment for my heroin addiction and withdrawals thereof with methadone only, and that in turn pretty much basically kept my addiction alive, and I went back to active addiction for a few years. When I got to Hooper Detox, I was introduced to acupuncture, and I know for a fact that it was the safest withdrawal method for me to kick heroin, and I am positive, without a doubt, that it sped me into recovery, which put me right into be the member of society that I am. It was painless, and it was a blessing, and it works.
Thank you.
And it is a lot cheaper.
Thank you for that question. Real briefly, I've never been in a treatment center before. I went through Hooper Detox and utilized the services through the Oregon Health Plan at Portland Alternative Health Center and the Mentor Program. So this is my first attempt at being clean. I was a nonstop heroin addict for 39 years. And I've been clean now for 3 years. And so I've never accessed treatment before. And had not this health plan been available, I can tell you where I would be today. In very few words, I'd be dead or back being supported by the state of Oregon and OSP.
Senator Brown.
I assume that then you were not, treatment was not available then for you while you were in.
I grew up in an era where that myth and stigma of once an addict, always an addict, once a convict, always a convict, and I believed that. I didn't know that this type of life was available to me until I sought treatment through the services that I mentioned before.
Was there any treatment, though, available in prison for you? I mean, obviously it was sort of a cold turkey situation, I presume.
Not during the time I did, no. It wasn't, the treatment didn't become available in prison until the later years. I did most of my time during the 70s and early 80s.
Senator.
Question, respect to heroin versus methamphetamine. Acupuncture.
Actually, acupuncture is useful for all drugs of addiction, nicotine, methamphetamines, alcohol, heroin, oxycodone.
And where would we get appropriate evidence-based research?
You've got it, sir.
Well, beyond that.
Beyond that, you can get it off the NIH internet line. You can, any med search line, all you have to do is type in acupuncture. And I would invite any of the committee members, I know you don't have a lot of time, but to come up to see a working clinic that integrates primary care with mental health and addiction treatment in, for a very hard-to-treat population that gets you very good results.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Mary Lou and Amy. And on deck is Steve Beringer, Gene Justice.
One of the court treatment programs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lou Henrich, and I am an OHAC board member, OHAC being the Oregon Health Action Campaign. And this is Amy Robin.
And I'm representing the Coalition of Statewide Safety Net Clinics.
And I guess I'll start out, and then Amy can, then we can, you can ask us questions. OHAC is a coalition of individual and organizations committed to empowering the consumer voice in development of health systems to give all people access to the care they need when they need it from providers of their choice at an affordable cost. I've given you about four pages of testimony. Can't do it in 3 minutes, so I'm just going to go through and give you some pieces of it, and then you can read it later at your leisure.
Thank you.
The main things that OHAC wants to say today, the two questions we were asked to address, is one, prioritizing people, and second is prioritizing benefits. And knowing that, you know, money is very tight, we don't live under a rock, we understand the pressures that you're facing. We want to say clearly, though, that we do not believe that you can prioritize the poor people. It's an intellectual exercise that I think I understand why you're trying to do it, to say, okay, this poor person versus that poor person. But, you know, numbers like 10% of poverty and 26% of poverty, are mathematical constructs. But truly, people who are less than the federal poverty guidelines are extremely poor. They don't have enough money. The federal poverty guidelines do not give you enough money to really have housing, food, medical care, and the basic necessities of life. So then when you start going down to, well, do you have 25% of that amount of money or 42% of that money, it really doesn't make a lot of difference. The one thing that we'd like to say is that the medically needy population, which you have chosen to put above some of the other poor adults, we really think that is not the way to go. And the reason for that being that actually, I'm not sure if you were aware, but most of or a high percentage of those medically needy population do have Medicare coverage. Now, Medicare does not provide pharmacy benefits, as we all know. So what's happening is the medically needy program basically has become a pharmaceutical coverage package for people with Medicare with incomes really quite a bit higher than the other poor adults that you're kind of prioritizing later. So we believe that if you really have to go through this and do this, which we don't want you to do, but we say then put the poorest people, the most vulnerable people first, and the medically needy after them. Although we believe this is Sophie's choice. I mean, and we shouldn't have to be doing this. We, at the end of my testimony, say we've got to raise revenue, and we give you some ideas and some things that we'd be supportive of, although we know that's not your job in this role. Okay, so that's number one. The second is that in terms of benefits, we'd like to strongly support what Lynn Marie Kreider was saying in her testimony, and that is that a package that you call, it's being called primary care or the access model, has several names. It basically would include outpatient physician services, diagnostic services, lab and x-ray, a basic pharmacy benefit, chemical dependency, mental health, and we believe dental is important in there too, at least at some level. Those services which really allow people to get in, get preventive care, get a hold of their chronic diseases early, keeps diabetics from needing to have leg amputations later, those kinds of things. We believe that for the standard population, if you really can't come up with the full money to have a one-tiered system, which of course, we'd all like to have, then we would be supportive of that kind of benefit.
Question, what would happen if an individual under that scenario mm-hmm. went to their doctor and it was discovered that they had a condition that required hospitalization?
Well, Senator Winters, I worked for Multnomah County Health Department for years, and we actually ran a program that was called Health Source for uninsured people. And that's exactly what they had. They could come into our clinics. We did their pharmacy, their lab, their primary care. But then when it came time that they did have cancer or they needed hospitalization, then we begged and borrowed and got charity care for the person. We had a little bit of money in what we called a Health Source fund that was a couple of $1,000s that could be put towards that hospitalization if it was needed. But our doctors, nurse practitioners, worked with the hospitals and were able, under their charity care policies, to get the people in. Now, I certainly don't think this is good long-term health policy for the state of Oregon, but in the crunch that we're in, we're saying that if you have to roll it back, we think that it can be done because most of the care that most people need is really on an outpatient basis.
Senator Courtney?
So the primary care access package does not include hospitalization?
No. As it's being laid out, and I think it was costed out for you, it does not.
Thank you.
The other things that I would like to point out is on page 3 of my testimony, we really want to talk and reiterate what you've heard about the premiums and, in some respects, the copays. If you look at the little chart I did in the center, this is taking OMAP's latest figures from their reports that are given to the Expanded Access Coalition and showing you the difference between the numbers of people that were by the various percentages of poverty eligible for OHP in March versus April. And what it shows on some of them, the highlighted, but my printer was going bad, so not all of you can see that, but it's line 1, where it's the 0 to 10% of federal poverty that in March had 32,000 and in April has slightly under 28,000. It's a 14% decrease in those poorest people. And then if you look down, in the middle, it's adults with children, the same thing, smaller numbers, but from 3,200 down to 28, a 15% decrease. So it really has affected the poorest people with this premium policy the way it is.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senators, and members of the committee, my name is Amy Robin, and I'm representing the Coalition for Safety Net Health Clinics in the state of Oregon. The Safety Net Health Clinics are clinics in the state of Oregon that cover OHP patients and those who are uninsured or uninsurable on a sliding scale basis. I handed in a handout there in each and every one of your counties. Currently, with the current budget cuts in the Oregon Health Plan, these clinics have absorbed not only more patients, but more complexity in care. Patients coming in with 5 different illnesses, with needs that are beyond our reach, homelessness, poverty, drug addictions, unavailability to get medications. We have seen an increase, and I know the clinic that I work at, which is a member of this coalition, is the North Portland Nurse Practitioner Clinic, and with one full-time nurse practitioner and one part-time nurse practitioner, we see between 200 and almost 300 patients a month. And with OHP standards being eliminated, with the hundreds of thousands of people that would be uninsured, the state, these clinics cannot absorb those people. I know I was asked to speak here today on a priority population, and that population is Oregon's most vulnerable people, those on Oregon Health Plan standard and the medically needy program. I believe the end goal of saving money and reaching the population, if the priority is taken for OHP Plus, will not be reached. I say this because I see it every day in the clinic that I work at, which is kids are covered, but when the parents are not covered and cannot receive their medication, cannot receive drug and alcohol treatment, the children suffer. I can give you one example of a child coming in for gangrene. The parent could not receive his medication. He was sick. He could not take the child to an appointment to get her medical needs met. Her medical needs spread into her whole hand, which ended up costing much more money. Oftentimes, these families are put out whether or not to pay a copay on a prescription or electric bill. They're put at risk of losing their home, and their child may have health care, but if they're on the street or if they can't receive services because their parent or caretaker is unable to get them there, it's not going to reach the end goal of covering that vulnerable population. So I urge that we cover Oregon's entire vulnerable population, because in the end it will save us all money and reach the end goal of covering those most vulnerable. And I urge you, these safety net clinics are in each of your counties, and I urge you to come and visit them to see the care we provide.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Barringer and Jean Justice. And then on deck is Dr. Patrick Haggerty, Stephen Duffin, Dr. Cedric Hayden, or Representative Cedric Hayden, and Mike Shercliffe. I'll call all the dental panel up, and Dr. Eugene Scortes. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Winters, member of the committee. My name is Steve Behringer. I'm here to represent the American Diabetes Association and the Association's Oregon Executive Director, Sally Norby, who's here with me today also. I've also had diabetes for 37 years, so I have some firsthand knowledge of the disease. I have kind of a full statement that's being passed out, but I'm just going to summarize it in the interest of time and kind of hit on the scope of diabetes and of the problem, and then you'll hear from Jean Jensen, who is on the OHP standard plan, about the situation that she's found herself in and the real-life impact of the disease. The scope of diabetes today is that it's an epidemic in Oregon and the United States. We have 17 million people who have been diagnosed with the disease throughout the country, and an equal number, almost an equal number, about 16 million who have prediabetes. Diabetes growth is estimated to continue for the next several years at 10% a year, which is what has made it an epidemic. Oregon's figures very much reflect that, as we've seen an increase among Oregonians with diabetes of 50% between the years 1995 and the year 2001. It's an increase from 4 to 6% of the state's population who have been diagnosed, and I've actually seen a more recent figure of 7% of Oregonians now with the disease. We estimate that within the Oregon Health Plan, there's 24,000 people with diagnosed diabetes, approximately 4,000 in the standard plan and 20,000 in the plus plan. So it has a very large impact within OHP. It cuts across all groups within the Oregon Health Plan, the plus plan, standard, medically needy, pregnant women in particular who suffer from gestational diabetes. Diabetes cuts across all ages, from right after birth to the elderly, all population groups, and affects minority populations disproportionately to the rest of the population. The costs of the diabetes epidemic are staggering. It costs the United States economy today $130 billion to care for people who have diabetes in direct and indirect costs. Costs in Oregon, the Oregon share of that is $1.7 billion in 1999, and no doubt it's increased quite a bit since then. The costs include not just treating the disease itself, the diabetes itself, but the expense of the treat complications, both short and long-term complications that occur when people don't have the proper equipment to take care of their disease, and particularly the durable medical equipment and supplies that are needed. That equipment includes, for those who may not be familiar with it, a small meter like this to test blood sugar anywhere from 1 to 5 or 6 times a day. Test strips like this that are put into the machine. You have to use one test strip each time you test. And also for people who use insulin, the syringes that are needed to take the insulin. If people don't have the syringes, they're unable to take their insulin. These are all among the durable medical equipment. Without those supplies and the ability to properly control the disease, you're going to wind up with the expensive complications of more hospitalizations and emergency room visits in the short term, blindness, amputations, and kidney disease in the long term. Numerous studies, and I've referred to a couple in the larger piece that I passed out, have demonstrated the reduction in all of the short and long-term complications and the savings that will accompany them. To give people the tools to manage diabetes does not cost as much as it is cost-effective, and that's been demonstrated time and time again. The best tool for managing diabetes and to control the costs is to help Medicaid enrollees who have been diagnosed with the disease to achieve tight control of their blood glucose. I urge this committee, and it's very difficult decisions that it has to make in the days ahead, to make diabetes coverage a priority as you address the difficult situation that you're in.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jean Justice. I'm requesting the reinstatement of durable medical supplies for the standard plan. Diabetics and other affected persons are dependent on these supplies to comply with their physicians' health treatment programs.
Ms. Justice, and I'm going to ask them as they come forward, because we have we adjourn at 6 o'clock and there's a lot of people who still want to testify. So I would ask if you give me if it's written, if you kind of try to summarize for us and hit the high points. I don't like to cut you off.
I shall. Thank you. Durable medical supplies are essential for a diabetic, for diabetic control and injections. You need to be closely monitored with your glucose, so you know what insulin level you're at, so you can tell. So you don't minimize the long-term effects of the diabetes, which is... Oh, I messed up. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
We need to know what the levels are, so we know what kind of treatment that we can get. If you need your treatment, your levels are high, you need to adjust your glucose, you also need to adjust your glucose through insulin and through your diet. The one thing with diabetes is everyone thinks you can tell if you're high or low. You can't. You can only tell without testing, if you're extremely high or extremely low is when you get the benefits. I can go on and appear normal, act normal, and have a glucose of 350, which it needs to be, let's say it would be nice to be 120. So you do need these durable equipment. Now, what I mean by durable equipment, I mean by syringes. What I should do is I should use a new needle every time I inject myself. What I do is I use the same needle for at least once a week, and it could be more, up to two. Another question on the comment is that medication is paid for, but I take insulin. I need a syringe. That is not paid for. I also run the risk, by using the same syringe, of infection and contaminating my insulin material, as careful as I am. I use appropriate procedures by using alcohol swabs on myself and also on my container. I use lancets to puncture myself to draw blood so I can find out what my glucose level is. I have been using the same lancet for, again, almost over a couple of weeks, because I need to contain the costs, because I don't have the money for it. Test strips, which was also demonstrated, is that I am supposed to take my glucose level 3 to 4 times a day. Test strips I may use once, and maybe I may use every other day, again, because I need to conserve my supply. I'm not fooling myself that I'm doing a good job. I'm just letting myself know that I still care. Complications. if I don't do what I should do, the complications involved if my diabetes is out of control is that I could lose my eyesight, develop kidney disease, nerve disorders, vascular and cardiovascular disorders, and also increase infection. Now, the personal impact on me by not having these supplies furnished. I have four other medical conditions. I take 10 medications with copay, totals $140 a month. Unfortunately, most of the medication I need to take are brand names and not generic. My durable medical equipment, the syringes, is $20 for a box of 100. My test strips are $350 for 50, and I need to take this is for 50.
$35.
And I do need, and I should be taking it four times a day, which if we averaged it out would be $41 a month. Knowing what I should do and knowing what I do is very painful. I want to live. I don't want to lose a limb. I want to retain my eyesight. I just need your help. I want to be a productive citizen again so when my diabetes is under control. I have no personal life. I have cut expenses to zip. Any event that I would consider attending is, number one, it has to be free. It has to have free parking or free ride access. And this is the way I have been living for the last year and a half. This is my second adventure out of the house this month. My health is important. My economic situation, I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but I had hit the wall and hit the wall again and hit the wall again. I'm unemployed. My unemployment has run out. I am a widow. I have no income. That's zero. I would love the $400 a month. I have no savings. No property. I do have a car. I don't drive it because I don't have any money for insurance or to renew the license because that is a luxury to be able to drive a car or have my car. I live with my mother, which I thought 5 years ago was the most disgusting thing any child should be able to do or have to do. I really have had to turn my tune around on that. Upon living with my mother, I realized her financial resources she has kept hidden from her children. She's living on Social Security only. She has no savings, and she can't even afford all of her medication. She's just $200 over the limit to get assistance. I'm not eligible for any kind of program to get help, to help pay her rent, so that we can get on our feet again. I'm asking for the reinstatement of this durable medical equipment for myself and for others like myself who do not have the extra $20 to buy syringes, taking risk of infection. We face tough decisions and financial decisions. As I said once, I cut back on everything else. My mother and I went through everything. We went through the grocery list. The one thing that we came up and we started laughing was, well, she says, the only thing I know we can't cut back on, she says, this is the toilet paper, because everything else has been taken care of. I looked at her and laughed, and I says, well, I'm sorry about that, but we may have to increase it because my diabetes is not in control, and one of the side effects is frequent urination. So this is how we have to live and how we have to go along. I hope this is temporary. I want to be a productive citizen. I want to contribute, but I need your help. And I'm asking not only for me, but for others that are in this situation that don't have an extra $20. Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee, thank you.
Dr. Mike Shercliffe and Dr. Cedric Hayden, also known as Representative Cedric Hayden, and Dr. Patrick Haggerty. We're going to try, we have about 6 individuals that we will call up later, and then the others we will schedule for tomorrow, just so that everyone knows. We're rapidly approaching 6 o'clock.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Patrick Haggerty. I'm a dentist in private practice in Albany, Oregon. I'm speaking about Oregon Health Plan dental coverage for the disabled, specifically the retarded autistic citizens of our state. Many of these people were former residents of Fairview Training Center. In July of 2000, Fairview closed and residents were moved to group homes throughout Oregon. At Fairview, the residents' dental needs were addressed. Because of their disabilities, cooperation is difficult and a general anesthetic is necessary. This was provided at Fairview. Currently, every Friday, I and my staff see 4 to 6 patients in the operating room at Albany General Hospital. Under a general anesthetic, x-rays, exam, cleaning, any fillings or extractions are done in one visit. This is done at 1/3 of the OMAP fee schedule, or 15% of my usual fee. Very low cost to the state. 13,000 patient visits since 1998. To cut this coverage is to abandon a population that has nowhere else to go. The suffering is unimaginable. Even with this coverage, patients present with infections the size of golf balls, entire sinuses filled with infection from abscess teeth. To cut this coverage is to allow these infections to grow to life-threatening proportions at even greater cost to the state. Fairview was closed for several reasons, but not to drop our responsibility for those who were dealt a very difficult hand. We cannot abandon these citizens. With this program, the state is getting a deal. The cost is very lean. To cut this program will not save money. It will cost the state even more. I'd like to continue to participate in this program, to use my hospital training and provide care. I personally have done 450 of these cases in the last 7 years. If all adults are eliminated, I will continue to serve as many as we can on a charitable basis, but nowhere near the need of the disabled adults. Dental coverage for disabled adults needs to be a priority. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we go to Dr. Mike Shercliffe. Is that correct?
Shercliffe.
Sure. All right,
it's actually like a shirt you'd wear and a cliff you'd jump off of. I'm sure you're feeling like doing that today, as I suspect. But thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Mike Shercliffe. I'm the president and CEO of Northwest Dental Services, which is a dental care organization which is owned by 250 dentists in rural Oregon. It's a cooperative of dentists. We formed exclusively to help with the dental needs of our communities. My testimony is before you, so I'm just going to take a couple points. First of all, I didn't give you the picture that I have. I just gave you 4 that I took off the shelf. We're here, I'm here not asking, it's very interesting to me to listen to the people speak, because a lot of them are people that we've made smiles for, people that are able to go to work. I personally know our company is over 1,000 people that have gone to work because they had a smile. Now, you can't go to work with a smile. Now, we're not here asking for smiles. We're here asking for a little program where we can take teeth out so people don't have to die. Okay? Now, to get that, we're also here asking for coverage for people that are at the end of their lives because of choices they made that didn't turn out correctly or because of disabilities that they have no control over themselves. We're at the end, and what we're asking for, and we've even offered up a strip-down program. okay? And so we come differently than a lot of groups. The governor I had an opportunity to speak with 4 weeks ago, and he said, you know, in the good times, programs get expanded, and in the bad times, we all have to offer up ways that we can share in the pain so we can get through the bad times. Now, dentistry has come to the table. We've offered up to share in the bad times to help in several ways, help the people of our community. Like Dr. Haggerty has said, those folks that truthfully you turned out of Fairview that now we have to care for, and now you're going to take the coverage away that you used to provide for them. Secondly, we've offered up programs that, very frankly, will allow people not to suffer, not to go to the emergency room. In your packet, I included one case that I saw in Northwest Medical Team's van in February, or actually March. The lady came to me and she said, would you please take my tooth out for me? I said, well, what's your story? She said, well, I work down at Burger King. I make minimum wage. I just get by. I don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan because I make $50 too much. My tooth is loose. I've been to the hospital emergency room twice. The cost has been $1,300 plus each visit. I am now unemployed because I had to take time off to go to the hospital. And so I gave you just a copy of a bill that came across my desk. These folks, we're just here asking for a program that will continue to help us and our communities help serve the people that need dental needs. The testimony's there. One other piece I just wanted to comment on. We certainly understand that your issues that you have for us. We stand ready to help in any way we can. We've stood ready to help in any way we can. We know the problem is monumental. There are things that we can still do. We don't want to do, but we can still do to help to make sure that the people in Oregon do not have to suffer. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Cedric Hayden.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senators, Administrator Taylor, good afternoon. It's been a long day for you. Thanks for being there. For the record, my name is Cedric Hayden. I'm from Fall Creek. I'm currently the dental director of Hayden Family Dentistry, a dental care organization, a very small one, in Oregon. I'm also a member of the OMAP, Medical Directors, Dental Directors, and Medical Contractors, and meet regularly with them about twice a month. I'm a formerly a low-income dentist in Trinidad and Tobago. I've had 30 years experience with low-income dentistry, and I don't know how to make it work. And it does work. It is a good program. I know how to use the resources that you give us wisely, and they are used wisely. I gave a speech in Eugene today, and they said, tell us about your legislative experiences, and we talked about the most important things, and I said, what is your most important asset? And your most important asset is your health. There's no question about it. That is the you can't do anything else. You can't do anything without good health. That is your best asset. I want to make just a very few points in the 3 minutes that you've given me. I'd like to say that I agree that the benefit packages should be based on the prioritized list. That has worked very well over the last 10 years. That benefit packages have logical components. They're even part of our dentist. They're even part of our language. Medical, dental go together. Doctor, dentist go together. The components of your plan should have medicine and dentistry. The populations that you are considering are ubiquitous. Everyone has a mouth, and the mouth is, as you've heard, connected to the rest of the body, to the esophagus, to the stomach. Everyone has teeth. They're in all of your districts. Just to pick a few counties, or actually Senate districts, at complete random. One Senate district has 43,000 Oregon Health Plan constituents in it. Senate District 6 has 33,000 Oregon Health Plan constituents. Senate District 11 has 30,000, and Senate District 21 has 18,000. We provide seamless care across every Senate district, Senator. We provide seamless care across every Senate district and every county in the state. There are no uncovered territories for dental care. As well as being compassionate and humanitarian, the benefit packages are prudent fiscal investments. Consider, there is a large federal match for every state dollar from the general fund that you invest. There is an enhanced federal match now, as Gene Thorne has told you. There is a grant of $112 million in addition to that. The dollars that you invest and the grants and the co-match, they grow jobs all across the state of Oregon. Now, remember that you recover state income tax on the federal match, and if a package is $100 million, you will recover about $6 million in state income taxes on that. So there is some return on your investment in addition to the health benefits that the people get. The benefit packages keep people healthy and able to function, and the cost per person is a very good value at about $10 a month general fund. Senators, I thank you for your time.
Senator Kay Brown wishes to speak.
Thank you. Dr. Hayden, we had a conversation yesterday here, and I expressed concerns about pulling dental care out of the prioritized list. I think Dr. Shurtcliffe was here. And while I appreciate you coming forward and offering solutions in this time of crisis, I'm extremely concerned about the legislature either making budgetary or political decisions and pulling a certain service or certain services out of the Oregon Health Plan prioritized list. Could you comment on that, please?
This book is the newest book. It contains the latest prioritized list. There are some 700 entries. The prioritized list, after months, even years, with Dr. Alan Bates and Representative Alan Bates and many others who worked on the Health Services Commission, they came up with a prioritized list, and it is a list of health services ranked in relative importance. Now, it's very difficult to do, but they did their best, and they came up with about 700 of them. Of those 700, things, about 35 are dentistry, dental-related, and they are scattered throughout the list. We think it is best, and we have no problem, if you start at number 700 and say we can't do 700, we can't do 699, 698, 500, or 600. That's the way the list was intended to work. When you have more money, you provide more services, but you don't eliminate people. When you have less money, you do less services, but you don't eliminate people. So, yes, I believe the prioritized list should be used, and I think you're currently considering perhaps going up to 519, and I see no particular problem with that. But I don't think that you should go in and take out mental health or take out durable medical equipment or take out dentistry or take out prescription drugs from the list. I think you should use the in total. So that there would be no pharmacy, no mental health, no dentistry in the list. I think you should go up or down the list. And it'll work very, very well. That is your best way of controlling the costs.
Thank you. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I just want to say when we were on the waiver application hearing committee meetings, the dental groups were the only ones that came in with suggestions of how they could supply something and extend their services and make it count for the people and keep them in a relatively healthy situation, and they cut nearly 50% out of their previous costs to do that. I challenged specifically, and my statement was, are the other provider groups not as smart as the dentists? But we don't have one other group in here today that's testifying that they're basically doing anything other than just trying to maintain the costs and the payments that they have and not coming up with ways that they can work in a time when we're economically challenged to still take care of people in a relatively well way. And they're not providing those kind of answers. And what do? We wind up and then threaten to take and then basically take the whole program away. They've been the only ones that really have come up with anything that's satisfactory in the way of helping us through this time with reduced costs and still maintaining relatively good health amongst our citizens. And so I just wanted to mention that here. I thoroughly appreciate the work and the effort that they've done to do this, and they did it voluntarily.
Thank you. And Senator Fisher is correct that during our hearings on 2519, the dental community did come forth with a package, and we're the only group that looked at what services they could provide given the scarcity of resources. With that, Pam Patton and Scott Lay and Mike Volpe. And then this will be the
Brandy
Satterwin and Carol Wall. And that's the that will be the last that we will hear today. And if there's any, if you have written testimony, would you give it to our staff? But we will adjourn after we hear from this last group. And those who weren't able to be heard, we will hear them tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Pardon?
Here in room A.
Here in room A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Pam Patton. I am Director of Government Relations at Morrison Child and Family Services in Multnomah County. And I'm here today representing the Department of Human Services, Multnomah County Child Welfare Advisory Committee, for which I am co-chair. The advisory committee is requesting that you consider restoring the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefits for alcohol and drug and mental health treatment for parents of dependent children in the state's custody. As you've heard many times today, the cuts to the Oregon Health Plan have dramatically affected alcohol and drug and mental health services access for parents whose children are in state custody and in foster care. We know from studies that there are 70 to 80% of parents of children in foster care who have chemical dependency issues. Many of these parents also have mental health issues. I want to give you a little bit further explanation about what the issue is in child welfare. The Federal Adoptions and Safe Families Act limits the amount of time that parents have to rectify the problems that brought them and their children into care. The intent is that children do not linger in foster care, but instead are achieving permanency. It is incumbent on the Child Welfare Agency to provide services for parents to be able to regain custody of their children. Without drug and alcohol treatment and mental health treatment, it is nearly impossible for these parents to be successful for child welfare or for child welfare to meet its obligations. Without the child welfare workers' ability to access appropriate and timely treatment for parents, it's likely that the length of stay of these children will grow much longer. And it is also a great probability that the state is going to end up raising many of these children. Our advisory board would like to make the recommendation that if there isn't funding for the best option, which would be restoration to all eligible adults of the benefits, then we would like to propose that you explore statutory and waiver changes within the Oregon Health Plan that would prioritize the parents of children in state custody who are in need of alcohol and drug treatment to stay on the plus category of the Oregon Health Plan while their children are in custody. We believe that that decision will, in the long run, save the state money. You heard earlier today from Ann Uhler that it could cost $25 million to keep these children in foster care. We also believe that that's in the best interest of our children to take care of their parents so that they can be returned to their homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Lay. I'm from Portland. I am here to support the Oregon Health Plan, but specifically to support the continuation of the employed persons with disability. You have my testimony, so I'll try to be real brief. Basically, Medicaid is crucial in my life, and I specifically say Medicaid because I get pharmaceuticals and durable medical equipment from the Oregon Health Plan, and I get in-home waiver services from the home and community-based waiver. So I get pieces of what keeps me active and independent from both pieces, from both services. I mean, Medicaid is crucial in my life. Without it, I doubt if I would be surviving. Prior to 1999, I had to make a choice of whether to be employed or to maintain Medicaid. You couldn't do one. You could not have earned income and maintain Medicaid. 1999, Oregon developed the first in the nation employed persons with disabilities program, which allowed, as was said earlier, people with significant disabilities. You have to have a disability that meets the definition used by Social Security. That is a very severe disability. And so it allows people with significant disabilities to work and maintain Medicaid. So before 99, there was no choice. Once EPD program was put into place, we had the choice to whether that we could work. Now it sounds like there is discussion about taking EPD off the table again and terminating it. Personally, I don't see the sense in that, because if the EPD is terminated, I will have to quit work. You will still pay my Medicaid expenses. You just won't receive my taxes. You won't receive my $266 a month cost share. And there are a lot of people in the same situation as I am. They will have to quit work if the program goes away. You will still be paying for their Medicaid. You just won't be receiving their taxes or their cost share. So a couple other things about the EPD program. Many of us who have significant disabilities use voc rehab, the state dollars put through to voc rehab. If we can't work, those dollars are virtually wasted. So you're getting more bang for the buck because of the EPD program. I'm trying to do this quick. I don't want to get it out of here. I want to hear Mike. So I think, you know, I will say, without the employed person's disability program, you will still be providing Medicaid to us. The eligibility criteria is no different. By letting us work, you're benefiting everybody. You're paying taxes. We're being productive. We're being more independent. So I will stop there unless there's questions. So thank you for the opportunity.
Senator Morissette.
Yes, thank you. I don't see your name on this page.
It should be right at the top.
Well,
maybe you got Mike Volpe.
Scott Lane.
I don't see it on.
That's right on top of mine.
You must not have the right one.
Scott Volpe.
Maybe he didn't get one.
It was double-sided, and they printed it.
Make sure it gets one.
We took care of it.
Thank you. I do have one with two sides now. I didn't do
that. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for explaining the EPD program better than it was explained before.
Mike.
Senator Moore said, I will gladly explain it over and over.
No. Thank you. I think I understand
it.
Thank
you.
Go ahead. Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
I just wanted to let you know that I learned about this program through a constituent of mine who was in the medically needy category and then got transitioned in this program when we cut off the medically needy. I was not aware of it. I'm very pleased to continue funding it, and thanks for coming today.
But you know, if some members of this illustrious group would like to learn more about some of these programs, they can come and sit with me on my budget hearings, and then they will learn all about these programs. Is that not right?
And if I may say one more thing, my email and phone number is on my testimony. Feel free to call.
Give Kate the brownie bus.
Senator
Fisher.
We're all fortunate that our good colleague from Springfield doesn't have a one-sided mind.
Mike, go ahead. You're getting carried away now.
Is my voice coming through?
Yeah, you're okay. Fine, Mike.
Co-chairs, rest of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Volpe. I have had I've been diagnosed with chronic progressive multiple sclerosis for 25 years. I'm 48 years old, so that's more than half of my life. I've been receiving care through the in-home care, through the in-home program, and the network of programs that is offered with that program for 10 years. In that 10 years, even though I am severely disabled, I've had one hospital stay. My health, other than my MS, has been remarkably good throughout that time. I credit that to the network of care that I have received. I have received in-home care, I have received medical benefits, pharmaceutical benefits, dental benefits until recently, and durable medical equipment. It is this network of benefits that enables people such as myself to maintain the best health that I possibly can, and they make a supreme effort every day in order to try to do that. Now we are being asked to try to prioritize these benefits. How am I to say whether my durable medical equipment is more important than my dental than my medical? It is the interweaving of these of all of the services that helps me to maintain my services or my health. And I really cannot do that. Another way that I am being asked to prioritize my services is through House Bill 3624, which then would basically mandate fee-for-service people, or people who are on fee-for-service, to go into to one of the health care programs, which then would limit their ability to choose the physician of their choice, and especially in rural communities such as Corvallis, where I live, there is a limit on the number of physicians in any one specialty. And so I would be that is a limitation of services to me and would threaten my ability to maintain my health. Thank you for being here so long, and that's in my testimony.
Thanks, Mike. Randy's back there. Randy's next, and Carol Wall is next, and then Dr. Eugene Sortes.
Okay. Madam Chair,
yes?
I want you to watch Scott get out of there. I think he could have a new career in teaching people how to parallel park. You got that thing in without running over a toe or banging anything.
No, now I'm going to screw up. Just watch.
But thank you. I've always been amazed because I've taken a handle of those a time or two and they don't respond just exactly like you think.
They are a bit touchy, that's for sure.
Why don't we start with Brandy?
Okay. Hi, my name is Brandy Satterlin, and thank you. I know you guys are wanting to leave here. I am an insulin-dependent diabetic, and I have been for 15 years. I'm 27 years
old. You don't look that old.
I know.
Look 15.
I'm 27 years old, and I have two little girls, a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And up until, well, also, I'm on Social Security disability. And up until recently, I've been eligible for the Plus plan, and they currently have now put me on the standard plan. Apparently, people that are on SSI can get covered by the Plus plan and have their medical expenses covered, but people on SSD, Social Security Disability, aren't given that advantage. So because of this, now no longer my pump supplies are no longer covered. I have to pay a copay. I have to pay premiums each month, and the expenses are just overwhelming. And now I'm to the point where I'm choosing between my health care and the things that I need to live as a diabetic and take care of my two children, or paying the bills. Social Security disability only gives me $646 a month, and my total expenses per month are over $800. That's just to run my household. And then my medical expenses each month are close to $500. And I don't know how I'm going to be able to live and take care of my children if there's no health coverage for me. And I just came to express my concern. And then also, I didn't know much coming in here. And then coming in and listening to everybody else speak, I'm hearing things about cutting OHP standard, and right now I'm getting barely what I need to live, and if OHP standard's cut too, I won't live. And I just came to ask you guys to please find a way to help. This is my mom. I'm sorry. I told myself I wasn't going to cry. And she thinks I'm going to do better.
Can't cry because you'll start me crying.
You have all of us up here crying.
She looks beautiful, doesn't she?
She absolutely does.
I have struggled for 15 years to keep her alive.
And you are Carol Wolf.
I'm her mother, yes. On my commute down from Wilsonville this morning to work for the Internal Revenue Service, I had no idea I would be here before you today, trying to speak on Brandy's behalf. My husband and I have assisted her and her children, but now with all of these cutbacks, you know, what are we supposed to do? Let our daughter die? You know, we can't have that. What am I supposed to say to my grandchildren if her supplies are cut and we can't afford the things she needs to sustain her life when that time comes? What am I going to tell them? We lived in a state that didn't care enough about your mother and her health needs, and we couldn't shoulder the burden. I don't want to be the one to tell my grandchildren that story. I also don't want to be the one to have to be their sole support. They need their mother. They need her in their life, and they need her healthy and active. She has turned her life around. 5 years ago, when she was pregnant with her first child, they put her on the insulin pump, which has greatly increased her quality of life. She is hospitalized less. Her extreme circumstances have become less and less. She's more active. But I've seen her struggle with her illness. She's held positions that pay $37,000, $40,000 a year. But she has lost them when her illness has forced her to be hospitalized and no employer wants to wait for her to get well enough to come back to work. And she loses the job. And then as parents, we step in and help her shoulder the burden. I'm just asking that you please take every consideration to help the people like my daughter and the gentleman who's spoken before us and the ladies. You know, anything that we can do to continue to give the people the supplies that they need to sustain their life, I would greatly appreciate. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Dr. Eugene, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Close enough, Securities. Senator Winters and members of the committee, I know it's late and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today, tonight. I'm Dr. Eugene Skirtes. I'm president of Willamette Dental Group. I still practice clinical dentistry, and we are a DCO, and at what time we serve 60,000 Oregon Health Plan patients, I think the number's down to 35,000. I was a member, I have a written testimony, so I know it's late, I'll keep this short, but I was an original member of the OMAP committee that came up with the prioritized list, and I do support the list, and I do support moving that list up to 519. It will still provide good basic dental care. We can't move it up much further because we're going to start to lose partial dentures, the treatment of periodontal disease, but at 519 it'll still work. I would love to have this include everybody, but I'm a realist. If the standard population cannot be covered, we have to cover the categorical adults. As you heard, these are the most vulnerable of our population. Their medical and dental needs are paramount. Up to 519, they still will have preventative care. They'll still have a periodontal care. They'll still have cleanings, extractions, fillings, partials, and root canals. We can't afford, though, to eliminate those services to that population. Many of them are being treated in hospitals and nursing homes. Many of them need to be sedated. An emergency type of program will not work. I also want you to know that when you heard about the $5 emergency, remember it is an extraction-only benefit. When I looked up our codes, I found out that we have 55 emergency codes and only four of those mention extractions. Most of what we do for emergencies are not necessarily extracting teeth. And so that would be a bare bone benefit. And it would put me as a dentist and as a provider in a moral dilemma when patients came in and all I could do is extract teeth. And in my example, I have a 20-year-old coming in with a broken front tooth. What am I going to do, extract his tooth? There are no provisions for flippers or any type of restorative work as well. So I don't want any of you to think that that emergency is going to be a true emergency, because we're talking about a extraction only, which will only cover very few of the true emergencies that we see in a dental practice.
Thank you for your patience.
Well, thank
because
you.
Everyone has been patient here today. And we will reconvene tomorrow
at 1 p.m.
At 1 p.m.
in Hearing Room A.
Hearing Room A. And with that, we are adjourned.